Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here. Thank you for those who are listening via the internet. This is a Volusia County School Board workshop. Today is Tuesday, October the 8th, 2019. And would you please stand and join me for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you once again. And for the record, let me just say that all school board members are present, and our school board attorney and our superintendent. We begin this morning's workshop with a continuation of where we are in the search for our new superintendent. And with us this morning, we have our consultants from the Florida School Board Association and also Kelly Schultz. So thank you, all three of you, for being here. Just ask you to identify yourselves and your title before you speak. And Dr. Vogel, are we going to start with you this morning?
Yes, I'm Bill Vogel, consultant for our School Board Association, and I'll turn things over to John. He's going to go ahead and lead us off with our interview schedule.
Thank you, sir.
Good morning. John Reicher, consultant with the Florida School Boards Association.
Good morning, John.
Good morning. Shall I proceed, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you. The first item on our agenda this morning is to review the sample interview schedules that I sent to Connie several days ago. Hopefully you've received them. They're in your packet. There's three samples. The first sample is reflecting the fact or the possibility that the board would choose three finalists for interview. You also have a second sample interview schedule should the board select four finalists for interview. And then the last document would be a sample should the board identify five finalists for interview on site. I think the schedules are pretty much self-explanatory, but just kind of to recap them quickly, any out-of-area candidates would arrive on the afternoon or evening of November the 6th, which is a Wednesday. And I believe in working with Kelly and talking with Kelly some, we are looking at housing those out-of-area candidates in the Daytona Beach area. Moving to the next day, which would be now, I'm sorry if I can back up, those who may fly into the area, Kelly's confirmed that there is shuttle service from the airport that would be able to take them to the hotel.
To a hotel that Futures has been working closely with for several years, and they said they're working with them right now to come up with a package deal for the candidates so they could stay there at a decent rate and have a shuttle to the airport.
Okay. Then moving to the next day, which would be Thursday, November the 7th. Depending on what schedule you look at, depending on the number of finalists, it reflects that if you have three finalists, the board would start their board as a total body interview with candidate A at 10 o'clock. And we've given an hour and a half for each of the board interviews where the board is interviewing as a total body each candidate. And while the board is interviewing, say, candidate A from 10 to 11:30 on the morning of November 7th, the other two candidates, assuming we have three, would then be doing school community tours. And I know that Kelly has worked with Futures to kind of identify host and a tentative tour route, and maybe if she could speak briefly about that.
Okay. Yes, Futures has three people right now that they've identified. If you choose to go with four or five candidates, they have other folks waiting in the wings to see if we need their help as well. So they are planning their entire day of taking the candidates around on these tours. And so, for example, if you did three finalists, the first finalist will be picked up at their hotel by one of the Futures members and taken right to DAC to do the interview, while the others will start on the east side and start their tours with two schools, we're thinking right now, and some things to sightsee, the Speedway and the beach, and And then when candidate A would be done with the interview here at DAC, they would start on the west side and hit a school here and then head to the east side. So the candidates will not meet each other or interact on that day as far as on the tours. And so we're working with them on that. Also, Futures has graciously offered to provide breakfast here at DAC for Thursday and Friday. And if, like I said, if there are four or five candidates, we'll just modify the route schedules and who will be taking them.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then, of course, on the evening of November the 7th, beginning at 6 o'clock, there will be a open community come one, come all reception to meet the finalists at the Sanborn Activity Center, located at 815 South Alabama Avenue in DeLand. And that would kind of wrap up that the Thursday activities. Then on Friday morning, November 8th, again, assuming we have three, the individual board interviews, one-on-one with each candidate, would begin at 8:30. And we've established an hour time for each of those interviews that the board would have with the individuals one-on-one. The lunch break is scheduled from 12:15 to 1:15, and lunch will be provided and hosted by the Volusia United Educators and AFSCME together. Board members, if you would, on that Friday, November the 8th, regardless if it's three, four, or five finalists that you bring in, if you would kind of be looking, you will note that I've not really entered a board member name yet. So if there is, I guess what I'm saying is, how would the board like to kind of assign which board member interviews on what schedule on that Friday? Sometimes maybe a board member has a early morning conflict, and it might be better, let's say if you're looking at the sample with three finalists, that the board member to the far right of that chart might have an early morning commitment and would prefer to be interview on that schedule. So I don't want to just assign schedules. Just be looking at that. And when the board gets to the point of identifying finalists, then we can maybe work with you to see what schedule might fit your schedule the best. Or we can just assign by alpha order, but we can talk about that. But just kind of be thinking about that Friday schedule as you look at the different sample schedules, whether we have three, four, or five. Then on the afternoon, assuming, again, there's three finalists, on the afternoon of Friday, November the 8th, around 3:45, the process will conclude. And then to kind of continue with our timeline, that following Tuesday, which would be the 12th, November 12th, the board has a meeting to select their next superintendent. So that's a quick review of the interview schedules with samples for three, four, or five finalists. And certainly if there's any questions, I'll be glad to ask.
Okay, board members, I believe Ms. Wright has a question. Ms. Wright, good morning.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. I have a question. When looking at the schedule, and the schedule is fine, on that Wednesday, and then I need to propose this actually to my colleagues as well first, with all of the work that went into getting or selecting the top seven, I felt it was rather imperative that we should allow that committee to interview each of the candidates, be three, four, or five, for at least in half an hour. It's one thing to select someone from paper. It's another thing for them to interview mm-hmm. with them. And so my question is, if we would bring them in Wednesday early, where maybe each of them could sit with the committee, the community committee, for maybe a half an hour, just for them to put eyes, put a name with the face. I want to know if you all are interested, or would you all consider that?
I think that's an excellent idea.
Because they put an awful lot of work into this, mm-hmm. and for it to get to this point and not having the opportunity to at least talk to the candidates for a half an hour, I think that would be a disservice to the people that volunteer their time.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Just let's kind of talk about it. Dr. Vogel or John, whichever one, So what you're saying is that those members of the Citizens Advisory Committee,
correct,
that's the committee you're talking about, that those members who wish to,
yes,
not that they're obligated,
right,
because it was, we couldn't get them to commit to the attending the two meetings, but we almost got them all there, but I think we had 23 or 22 out of 25. But anyway, those from the committee who could and wish to be part of it, that they would be able to see the three finalists, and then they would be able to
interact,
or are you thinking not interact like a social thing, but are you talking about one of the finalists would meet with a committee, and the committee would ask them questions similar to what we're going to be doing later, or were you thinking just to socialize
you're correct, not to socialize, but not to have so much a formal questioning, just allow them to introduce themselves to that committee. Who are you based on the resume? I have your resume in front of me, and you may have one person leading, or even our school board attorney could be there.
Mm-hmm.
Just for them to introduce themselves and maybe have two questions already prepared,
right, that's
for them to ask, because it's not long and it's not for them to circumvent this process or usurp our authority. It's just, I think they put a lot of time in it, and it would be good for them to see and hear the candidates, because
okay,
it's one thing to see somebody on paper, because they could be wonderful on paper.
Right.
It's another thing to see them in person.
All right, and then after that's finished, let's say,
mm-hmm,
and are you still thinking that, let's say we're that committee, and there's one of the candidates there, so they would ask their questions,
correct,
to that one candidate.
Correct.
Then that candidate would leave.
Yeah, go with the handler, go to dinner, whatever we had scheduled with Futures for that evening. Or
well,
anything.
That's
any dinner that
nothing. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
So that's Wednesday. You're talking Wednesday.
Yeah, bring them in
early
Wednesday,
okay,
so that after they met with that body, they could go do whatever he or she decided to do.
Okay, or they just leave and they go
right
to their hotel or whatever they're going to do. All right. So then the next one comes in, and they do the same thing. You're talking about like a half an hour.
Yes, just a half an hour.
Okay.
Again, you don't want to get too long.
Okay. And then I guess my thinking would be, okay, so now what happens after that? Like, they've asked their questions. They've formed their opinions. Do you expect them to tell us anything about their thoughts, or is it just you wanted to extend the courtesy to them? So there's no formal formalization of taking notes, and gave them a chance to meet them and say, oh, okay, well, this is great, you know, and okay. Okay, I just want to make sure that I'm on the same page with you.
They'll probably come and talk to you anyways if you selected them. But
right.
I'm just saying, I just thought it was a courtesy.
Okay.
So I was trying to get your feel and take.
Right, and sure. And before I get you guys involved, I see our consultants taking notes here. John, Bill, any comments, or you need some more clarification from board members?
I can make a couple comments.
Yeah.
I'll start.
And Bill, if you can grab that mic and just pull it in a little bit closer to you.
First, what we've tried to do with the schedule that has been presented is the meetings on November 7th are open to the public. So all of the people on that committee, if they would like, can come to that meeting. The other thing is that we, at the community reception, before anyone leaves, there will be an input form, and it will be, you know, some of the positives, some of the questions, and just general questions. So those at that meeting, if people come to that meeting, we could have those input forms for them, and they could give the board input, and we get those to them. So The second is that the community reception that night, the agenda would include an introduction by each of the candidates, about a 3-minute introduction of each candidate. So then they would see them and they would be interact personally. Mm-hmm. If the board decided to have them come in earlier, first of all, we said they were going to come in the 6th, 7th, and 8th. They would come in on the 6th. We might have to see if they're available to come in the night before. And then, which might not be a problem, but then we'd have to structure this very carefully. And I'd ask the attorney to comment on this. The reason I say that is we didn't have every one of those committee members at every meeting. So the question would be is, the committee members, if they come, should be at every one of those times when they would talk with the candidate. The other thing we would have to do is make sure that the questions were the same. Mm-hmm. And the third we'd have to do is there would, just as we talked about, they wouldn't rank them, but they would have to use that same form. Each committee member could do the strengths, the questions, and just general issues. We usually have like the strengths of the person, the questions about the person, and then just general comments, just a form like that. And all that would be given to the board. So, you know, we are very flexible and we can do that. But there would be, you know, some things that logistics that we would want to make sure we were following the Sunshine Law. And then another question that we'd have to answer today, I've already talked to Mr. Doran about it, is the committee was charged with a certain task. They have completed that task. And so the question is, would they still remain under the Sunshine Law further in order to continue to function as a committee? So what I'm saying is, logistically, there's a way that we can do that, but there are some questions that would and some procedures that we have to mm-hmm. work through before we did that.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. Sure. If we went through it, the other thing, because I think our plan right now was to disband the committee and get them off the Sunshine Hook,
yes.
if you will. And what was our date?
That was my understanding, but you guys can do change.
Sure, right. of course. So we can keep them.
But I guess I'm trying to think through.
Yeah,
because
yeah, I am too.
If they're not being asked to do anything other than, you know, give them the opportunity to meet with the candidates. In other words, if they're not being asked to make any further recommendations, ever take a vote again, et cetera, or are they the committee or not? And then, but at the same time, you're limiting access of the candidates to only what would be either committee members or former committee members, and does that make them continuing as a committee as a matter of law? And so, you know, I don't know. In my mind, whatever you guys decide you want to do, I'm just going to make it work. Legally, I'll tell you what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. But there's a number of variables there.
Yeah.
So we just have to sort through that.
All right. Let me ask Ms. Haynes and Ms. Cuthbert to ask their questions, and then we'll continue to talk through this issue. Yes, Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so my first question is, what time do we have the Sanborn Center starting on that?
6 o'clock.
So 6 is when the earliest we can get in there?
Oh, no, we have the room from 5 o'clock to 9 or 9:30.
Okay, so first of all, I think to keep it clear, and I appreciate every committee member, and I love the fact that they accomplished this in 2, you know, meetings versus 4. I like the idea of giving them a chance. I think really it's more of like a meet and greet, I don't want to attach it to it's an interview or anything like that, because it implies that they're going to do something and give us feedback again that, you know, could persuade us one way or the other, which is, you know, because then you're limiting it to 25 individuals. What if we just allowed the committee? It would work really if we could get the Sanborn Center just a little bit earlier on that day. And like if they're, you know, the committee was at the Sanborn Center, mm-hmm. and the applicant went ahead and went on over there, and they each got a time where the committee could just meet with them mm-hmm. prior to the reception, because then we're not adding an additional day and tying up more people. I'm just throwing out a recommendation.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I'm happy. It'd be nice for those people to just be able to put a face and, you know, meet them in person. That always means something. But not make it so that it appears
like it's another interview.
Interview. Because they will have they're going to sit through the interview with the board all day Thursday. They're going to be interviewed by all of us on Friday. You know, I think we've all done our homework, just like a lot of the committee members. We went out and searched for additional information. We've looked to see if they have ed talks and videos and things like that. It is still nice to do it, but I would more want to lean towards it's a meet and greet because they played that role versus it being an additional interview.
Let me follow up with Bill and John just on this, and then Ms. Cuthbert, I'll get right to you. And with Ted, if this would be okay. Could we arrange something following up on Ms. Haynes' suggestion, I'm going to call it like a VIP or something, but a special time before the general public reception where the members of the committee, again, those who choose to, could have some time, say, starting at 4:30 till, I don't know, 4:45, where those members from the committee could meet and just have some time with the three finalists, and the three finalists would be introduced to let them know that these are members of our Citizens Advisory Committee, and they would like to, you know, meet and greet you. So something special for them to acknowledge that their service to us, and we greatly appreciate it, and we wanted them to have the opportunity to have a face-to-face, to Ms. Wright's point about, rather than just seeing their names on a resume, it's nice to see the person, and to make it a little special for them too, for the committee members, and have that just that private time. So of the 25, if 12 of them decided to show up, that'd be great. I mean, I think they would like that. Would that be legal and possible, Ted? Yeah.
Yeah, we're saying no board members attending.
No board members there.
Right.
Just
and
the committee.
Just something like 30 minutes before the main event, and
whatever time frame you all think would work.
As part of this, we're saying the committee will be disbanded.
Disbanded.
Like today.
Right.
In other words, they're not going to continue as a committee.
Okay.
Right.
And their input cards would be that of the end of the night, all the cards are going to be
exactly. And I want to give Ms. Cuthbert a chance here because she's been waiting patiently. Ms. Cuthbert, do you have a comment?
Yes, I was going to suggest something exactly what Mrs. Haynes did, a little hors d'oeuvres with the committee, maybe from 5:15 to 5:45, a half an hour, like Mrs. Wright suggested, but not just for them to interview, but for them to say, I am the CEO of the hotel motel industry. I head up Evolution Manufacturing, just so the applicants know people of the community as well.
That's good.
So, and I think it's more of an exchange of introducing themselves. I am your representative from the NAACP. I am the representative of the District Advisory Council.
That's a good point.
And, you know, and I want my student to be there to say, I represent
Volusia County Schools.
All the Volusia County School students. Right. You know, I would like for them to be introduced to the candidates, so the candidates have a little more personal contact with our district as well. Mm-hmm. I would like for the candidates to feel comfortable coming to Volusia County. And they're going to be interviewed just like you said. They're going to be interviewed all that time. It would be nice for them to say, can I interview you just a little bit?
Right.
So
I think we have
is great. And that way no person can really dominate
them.
Half an hour, and, you know, somebody's going to step in front of a candidate and occupy 10 minutes of their
time. I'll tell Mr. Davis to stay home that day so that we won't have any domination.
But yes, and that way they have the opportunity to meet that committee have a sampling of all the different stakeholders in the county.
All right. Well, now let's thank you. And I see a lot of school board members' heads nodding with that. And now, Bill, John, what's your reaction?
Let's assume that at the most we have five finalists, and I'm going out on this timeline. So if you look at your five finalist interview schedule, candidate B would finish up on Thursday at 5:30 with the interview with the board.
Right.
The other candidate prior to that, they are done at 3:45. The candidates are done by 3:45 with the exception of B. We could have a singular room. Kelly says there's a room over there that maybe we can have this a reception for the advisory committee, and I'll work on a schedule prior to the community, the open house, where we can have the candidates come in for maybe no more than 30 minutes.
I think we can do everything that you're talking about at the reception, because the reception time is 6 to 8, but it was not even probably going to take that long, given that they have 5 minutes to speak each. So we could do that in another room there from 6 to 6:30.
Right. And the last candidate, again, if we have five, the last candidate may be finishing up right at 6 o'clock, or maybe runs over a little bit with the advisory committee, depending on the schedule. But then that candidate would be able to come in after the other four have done their 2 or 3 minute intro to the big open house and finish up. I think with a little work on the schedule, we can make this work. I would suggest that maybe rather than having the advisory committee ask specific questions, it is more of a kind of meet and greet, you know, like refreshments. And maybe we ask each candidate to maybe address one topic that we think is after the introduction, you know, maybe my first 100 days, here's something I would like to do. It's a 10-minute, and I think we would have to have the kind of limit that time, so we and one of your FSBA reps would be there to basically make sure we stayed on schedule. There's appropriate, you know, interaction between that group, but you know, there's plenty of time with three or four candidates. If we go to five, we can make that work as well.
Okay, let me bring it back to Ms. Wright. This was a great idea, so I want to just keep it going. Yeah,
but again, just to keep it simplistic, rather than them asking questions. And I think I like Linda's idea, allow the members who choose to come introduce themselves, because I think it would be great for them to know who's in the room, especially, and most of them are community leaders. So I'd rather not get into asking questions.
So good.
Scratch that and just allow them to introduce themselves.
So just for clarification, it would be each candidate 3 to 5 minutes, introduce themselves, why they'd be a great superintendent.
That's what they're going to do at the public, at the general public one. But
so this is more of a true social.
Yes.
And so when you're the candidate, each of us will introduce ourselves. So I represent Bethune-Cookman. She represents.
Yes, ma'am.
Whatever. So they will know who's in the room. Yeah. So don't have the candidates really say anything other than
their
name.
I really like this, because it's kind of a reverse.
This
is an opportunity for the candidate to meet the community leaders, which you spent a lot of time pulling together. I think it's an excellent idea.
Yeah, I do too.
And I really like the way the board has come together on this. It was a good idea, and you know, that's really, and we can do that.
Yeah. And actually doing it this way, Ms. Wright, too, would eliminate them having to come one day earlier,
right.
which
right.
is
yes.
always good, too, for
right.
them being busy
and I
people,
think,
I'm
yeah,
sure.
And,
so.
I, and I think that one day earlier, you know, as we've advertised to the candidates, you have to be available on the 6th, 7th, and 8th. So to say one day earlier, I think would put them in a bind. So I like it before. And I would assume, of course, kind of yielding to the professional attorney, but if this is more of a meet and greet, then I don't think there's any issues.
No, there's no issues.
Okay.
So we could potentially
great.
Kind of disband the group. And
Mr. Cologne, did you want to say something? I don't want to exclude you. Okay. And Ms. Cuthbert, yeah.
There needs to be some punch or something. Keep it straight. Nothing added to the punch. just something relaxed because food and drink or even just crackers and cheese helps relax everyone. And it's a little welcoming. But they need to know who we are as much as we need to know who they are.
I think this is an excellent idea. And I think of myself, that would have been very helpful for me if I met the community leaders in an informal setting like that right up front.
Yeah.
Because that kind of gets you, you know, there to get a good lay of the land in the community. So I think that's an excellent idea.
Yeah, you know, and I do too. And I thank you again for bringing it up. But I also think as a candidate, it makes you feel great looking at someone that you know picked you. I mean, you know, you were, you know, because you are telling them it was a unanimous decision to, you know, to get these final seven. So whoever the final three are, let's say, you know, that community member and that candidate will know, well, you know, that gives that candidate the opportunity to say thank you, you know, and that's always nice. Yes, Mr. Cologne.
If we tried to engage our chambers, I'm sure they can arrange for punch and crackers.
Yeah. I believe Futures is already handling that as well at Sanborn Center. So we'll
good.
Have food.
Perfect.
Good. Well, that's excellent. All right. Well, what a great thing to do. So so we really haven't changed the schedule other than just kind of moved it up a little bit, an hour maybe ahead of the 6th starting.
We won't even need that. Like, we can do it at 6 o'clock if
we can
that works,
do this.
We're going to use the whole 6 to 8.
Do this special. No, but this special reception needs to be at, I think,
a little
at
earlier.
5 o'clock.
You think it still needs to be earlier?
About 5.
Yeah,
5:15.
At 5 o'clock or 5:15. Yeah.
We worry about the candidates that are still doing
5:30?
Interviews.
Well, we may not have one at that time.
We
okay. may
not have 5.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't think we need to cross that bridge yet.
And Chairperson, again, the clarification for me, in meeting the... In this social, we'll have all the finalists together at once with
yes.
the committee.
All the finalists all. With all of the committee members who choose to attend. Yes.
Right.
That's everyone's understanding, right?
Yes.
Good?
Okay.
And Ted, yes.
Okay, so this is the appropriate time then to just maybe confirm that the committee is, its work is completed, effective now. Everybody agrees with that.
I don't see any other responsibilities
everybody.
That they have as
and
a committee.
And, Mr. Chair, we did tell the committee when we adjourned at the last meeting that they were still under sunshine until they received a specific notice through that email DL list from the board's attorney.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I
Ms. Wright.
That we disband our committee as of this exact moment.
Huh? What's that? Oh, we can't vote because it's a workshop. But I don't think we need a vote. I think we're okay. As long as everybody's, you know, agreed. The bigger problem would have been if we were trying to expand their role,
okay.
then we probably would have needed a vote for that.
Okay.
But since we're just staying with the original plan,
okay.
and so we don't really need a vote to, I just, on the in public on the record, we're saying everybody's in agreement, they've completed their work, their assignments. And I'll send out, or maybe if you want to, maybe draft up something
both,
for
yeah.
you or both. We'll
both
send
us,
something
yeah.
out
yeah.
thanking them for their service, and I'll put in a line that says that you're no longer covered.
Okay, great, because I have had one call from a committee member.
Okay.
You know? So I said, no, you're still under sunshine, so
yeah.
Wait till you get the official word.
All right,
so
yes,
we'll
try and get that
John
done.
And I are probably saying the same thing, but you could also invite the committee members to this reception.
Oh, at the same time.
Yeah.
And I really like it with the chairman and the board attorney sending it out, and then they get an invitation. I know John was going to say that, because you always say the same thing. But then you've covered three things in one: thanking them, inviting them, and releasing them.
Like it. Perfect. Good suggestions. Yeah. It's awesome. Awesome. Go ahead, John.
I'm just tentative thinking that probably this meeting would start, say, at 4:45.
Yes.
No. No, 5:45. 5:45 to 5:15, then that gives the candidates 15 minutes to get ready for the 6 o'clock reception.
That sounds good.
5:15.
Yeah, 5:15 to 5:45. Yeah, you just said it the other way around. Otherwise, it's 23 and a half hour meeting. So we don't want to do that. All right.
Well, then we won't need another room. We can just do it in the same room.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just to kind of touch briefly on the continuation of the timeline, currently based on our timeline, the board is scheduled on October 15th to return to identify semifinalists. Should the board want to have semifinalists, there have been boards at this stage on October 15th that would have said, we're ready to look at potentially identifying the finalists at that meeting. So on the next meeting, which is October 15th, the board will kind of discuss, does the board as a body want to look at semifinalists, or does the board want to go ahead and identify finalists at that point?
Okay, John, can I stop you right
yes.
there? And board members kind of think through this as I'm talking. So let's just say on October the 15th, that's next Tuesday. I think we had a special meeting scheduled at 2 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And so at that meeting, would you go around to each board member? Let's just say one way to do it would be like you did previously with the interim superintendent. And you said, okay, Ms. Haynes, give me your three finalists, let's say. And Ms. Haynes announces her three names, then Ms. Wright, and so forth and so on. And then you tallied which of the candidates received the most votes, and then those become the finalists. Is that one way
yes.
that you were considering doing it,
yes.
Bill? We did not ask for a specific number.
Okay.
We would just, you know, any board member could submit 3, 4, 5, or 7, or however they would like to do it.
Okay, so in other words, you would ask, going back to Ms. Haynes here, Ms. Haynes, you would identify your top candidates, or I mean, obviously you don't want her to pick all 7 again, so what?
Well, I think the clarification would be that are we asking the board members to identify semifinalists or finalists?
Okay, and I am proposing at this point that we would be identifying finalists after October the 15th. And so that, let's say we identified finalists, that we still have that meeting October 29th schedule on our plan. That would give the board from October the 15th to October 29th, which is 2 weeks, right? That'd give each board member lots of time to really take a deep dive into each of the finalists, who whatever number that turns out to be, 3, 4, or 5. And then on October 29th, I guess it is that when you were going... Is that when you were planning on informing the finalists who they are, or?
Well, as soon as the board makes a decision to identify finalists, we would notify those candidates that same day.
Okay. And what if, here's a what if, and I know that you've all have done background checks on these people, and will continue to do more between now and October 15th.
Yes.
But what if the board had selected three or four people on October the 5th, the 15th, but then some concerns were raised between October 15th and October 29th. Could the board then come back and say, you know, change my mind about this particular candidate? What are your thoughts on that? Has that happened? Have you dealt with it before?
We really haven't had where the finalists have been changed by the board. We've had a case where a finalist has withdrawn
from
consideration. And I do not believe that the board added a replacement. I think they just went with from four finalists down to three finalists.
Got it. Okay. All right. I've just thrown out a scenario, and but I think what's great for us as a board is that we have this time. We have a lot of time, and so we're not pressured. We don't have to make a quick decision. So I see Ms. Haynes with a question and ask questions, and we'll move this process along.
I thought the purpose of the semifinalist piece, which, you know, we have seven names that have been recommended at this point, was to, the next step we were going to do was to ask those individuals via email to respond to, like, two questions that we could see how they responded to, which would then possibly assist us in lowering it to the three or four finalists. Mm-hmm. So are we just going to skip that step and anything?
No, I'm sorry, and I'm glad.
I kind of wanted to see how they a written response to a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I did not say. I had spoken with John or Bill about that, and they indicated that as a result of what happens here today, that they would forward those questions today to those seven folks, and then they would have their responses back to us before our meeting on the 15th.
Okay. What we did in preparation, we always try to be prepared for what might occur based on what we heard at Citizens Committee meetings and from the board. We drafted up five questions, and we'd like the board, we think three would be sufficient, or if the board had another one, and what we'd like the board, or you can change the questions. This is just a draft.
Ms. Cuthbert.
I like what you said, Dr. Vogel. Why don't we allow them, and this is what's so good about education, there are five here. They can pick any three.
That'd be fine, too.
Pick three out of the five, because to me, when I would assign an essay, I would give them five. They had to select maybe two to answer, short answer. But it tells me something, which questions they decided to answer. That tells me something a little bit more about the candidate. Well, it does.
We're fine if the board would like to do that. And if the board doesn't like these questions, we're happy to, whatever the pleasure of the board is. What we do is, our job is to kind of listen to the board over a period of time and kind of think of items for you to consider.
Okay, Ms. Wright.
I agree with you, Linda. The only concern I would have, because then we kind of prejudge someone, supposing they don't answer number one, but number one is important to you. I'll say that. And they answer two others that are important to me. So I think that can skew how we look at a potential candidate based on what we feel is important. So I think, I do kind of think we should give them two or three questions and make all of them answer. That's just my opinion, because then that just removes any...
When you first said that, it was funny you said that, because... You're such a teacher. I could just see my teachers doing that, and I could just see it. No, but I love it. But I was also thinking, well, force them to answer maybe two, and then they could pick any one of the other three, you know, something like that, which I still kind of gets to your point.
Compromise.
Okay, and also addresses what Ms. Wright was saying, because there are some that are perhaps a little more important than others. Yeah. I didn't want to interrupt anybody. John, did you want to continue?
Well, yes, and if the board could identify those two today, and we can let them know the third one is their option, then we can provide them with this information early this afternoon, as soon as they get back home, and ask them to have that 500 words or less. Usually you don't want...
It's one page usually.
Base 500 words or less, and have it back to me by Friday evening. Then Saturday I can... Or I usually send things to Connie. I mean, if send it to Connie, and then she can get it to y'all first thing Monday morning.
Is that good, board members, or would you rather have it sooner? Or is there anything that prevents you from sending it right to us, or is that not the way you usually like to do it?
I have done that before. It's just, you know, it's to y'all copied to the agency clerk.
Well, is there any way that we could get it by Friday night somehow?
If I have your personal emails, I can.
Because then that'd give us Saturday and Sunday. Yeah. You know, that's for a lot of folks who are busy, and it'd be the only time.
The personal emails.
He doesn't need personal emails, does he? You all have access to your emails.
No, we have our regular emails. We can access it, our school emails.
Don't do it to personal.
Okay.
School district emails.
Yeah. Connie will provide me with where I need to send it.
And
yes.
Miss,
thank you.
Miss Haynes, yes.
Okay, so if these questions, we select two questions that we want answered by everyone. They can choose the third one. It goes out to them
today.
We have it by Friday evening to read. When we meet on the 15th, can we go ahead and be prepared at that point to name who we want as our finalist, or are we going to drag it out to the 29th? Because... I know we can hold, I mean, I'm ready to make a decision, but I'd like to see their answers. I mean, I know we can kind of hold hotel rooms, but if we hold it till the 29th, they're going to be scrambling to get flights.
Oh, no. On the 15th, we will identify our finalists.
Okay.
And so that they'll give them plenty of time to make their travel plans to get here on November. Yeah.
Six.
So now what I believe they want from us is to identify the two questions that we all feel like they got to answer. Yeah,
so
you
got
to answer. Ms. Cuthbert, I'll start with you. Which two do you absolutely, positively want them to answer?
One and three.
Ms. Cuthbert likes one and three. And Mr.
Cole. One and three.
One and three. Ms. Haynes?
I'm one and three.
Well, it's unanimous. It is just one and three.
That's what a teacher will do for you.
I know. Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. Thank
it's a
you,
mom, because she knows what you're thinking.
Yeah. I mean, well, those are the two. I mean, let's face it. Those are the two.
We are flattered that you thought our questions were sufficient.
Is there any penalty if they answer all five?
And,
because I can tell you,
if I'm
a candidate,
somebody will.
Well, I would think that every single one of them will, because if they don't, they're crazy. Because why wouldn't they, unless you tell them they can't?
Please limit to just the three.
This is a test.
Okay.
If you follow instructions,
they're going to think, I'll get bonus points.
Why would you answer all five? Because then you've got it all covered in case somebody wants one over the other.
I know.
Unless you tell them that they are limited to three.
We're going to tell them.
Okay.
We're going to tell them.
So what's the third one you send them?
Now let me ask the board members about October 15th at 2 o'clock. I can't even remember why we picked that time of day, but I guess it was a good time for most of you.
I can't tell you why.
I don't know. It's kind of a random time, but day.
And that morning, correct?
I think, Ruben, you may have had something early, and we said, I think after lunch would be good. I don't know. I mean, I maybe you guys, did you all have something earlier or later? Or
I think they did it for me since we had some.
You have a conflict. So
yeah,
early.
I think so. I mean,
they had a conflict.
We have a conflict earlier.
Okay. All right. That's fine. And would it be safe to say that meeting at 2 o'clock would probably only last an hour? I mean, tell me what
you... If not less.
Or if not less. Okay. So just so board members can put it in their schedules that it's...
And Mr. Chair, I will look at the timeline and modify the item to be discussed on the 15th from semifinalists to finalists.
Okay.
And we'll modify that and post the updated timeline based on your direction today on the portal.
And to Ted, the question, if when the finalists, when John gets the answers and he sends them to us, then that's public information at that point?
That's a public record
point.
That point, yes.
Okay. All right.
I also like one thing that you all said. I think Ms. Haynes said it, though, but it gives you a good 2 weeks to really vet out the finalists that you have before they come into.
Yeah.
So I think that was a good suggestion.
Yeah, I like that, too. I like having that time. Okay. John,
and
go
Mr.
ahead.
Chair, I'm sorry. Apologize. But if we're kind of moving up the schedule to identify the finalists on October 15th, would there be a need for your meeting on October 29th?
That's our board.
Oh, I get it.
Okay. It's just a normal board meeting. Yeah,
we
and that's a one that starts...
questions or whatever.
Yeah, and that one starts at 5:30.
5:30.
So
yes, Ms. Haynes.
If we actually choose the finalist on the 15th, we'll know if it's going to be 3, 4, or 5. So we can go ahead at that point and confirm the schedule.
Yes.
Because, these gentlemen have come here a lot.
I know.
And so I'm thinking
reading my mind,
we can let them off on the 29th and remove
them
from...
I'm thinking that as well. Yeah, Ms. Haynes. I was thinking that as well. I'm just saying put a placeholder in it, and I can't imagine why we would, need for you all to make this trip on the 29th. But perhaps we'll have a better understanding of that after the 15th.
You all are so kind, but after this search is over, we're going to have withdrawals. Really excited to work with you, all of you.
That's great. No, you all have been great.
Just a reminder, make sure that the agency clerk has your questions for interview with the finalists. I know that a couple of you have gotten them to Connie, and she might be missing one or two, but these are the questions when the board interviews as a total body for each candidate. Just be sure to let Connie know. And I think at this point, online survey update from Ms. Kelly.
All right. So we posted this online survey on August 23rd. It was up until September 30th on our district website. We also sent out the links to the community to let them know that this was here, try to draw people to the survey to get their input. We put it out on social media several times throughout that month. And we had about 800 people respond. And I sent you a link in your email, and I also put a packet near you to show the results. Tom Melton did a nice job of breaking everything down so it's easy to read. With the number of responses and what the percentage is to that response for the answers, the multiple choice questions. And then if you get to page, five pages in, the survey questions that they responded to where they wrote what was important to them, that part, if you go online, you can click on the link and you can read the responses. It was really long to try and print all of that out. So it's a breakdown of how it all maps out. And at the very end, you can see the list of the zip codes who voted. So you can see what areas voted in which way. So I think that's it.
The team did a wonderful job with that survey, and we really like the way you changed the format to identify the most important. And also, we recommend looking online and looking at the individual comments. It's always some good information. information that comes out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Great job.
Thank you, Kelly.
Thanks.
Nice work.
And Kelly, you are going to post that to the portal.
Yes, it's posted on the portal. It was posted this morning or late last night. So where it said where we had the survey, we replaced that with the survey results. So anyone would like to see it online.
So, Kelly, they still click on superintendent search?
Yes.
And then from there they get
from
into
there, there's a list on the left-hand side where they can click on the survey results.
Survey results.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you. Excellent.
I believe we're done, sir.
All righty, board members, questions for our consultants?
I think what we should
anticipate then on October the 15th at our meeting, John, is since we likely won't be seeing you again until November, whatever that day is, 6, 7, 8, probably just want to go over those details once again to make sure we got everything tight. And I guess from that point, Kelly, you'll really be involved in even a bigger way as our communication with Futures to make sure we're all in sync. And
right. And Mr. Chair, on the 15th, our interview schedules, I'll modify that to kind of show the earlier reception.
Right, because then we'll know how many.
Yes.
And then that will guide us
through
the schedules.
Did indicate to Kelly that, you know, even after that, I'll probably just run over here one day and we'll sit down and just kind of work on the details to the 6th, 7th, and 8th, and also the reception.
Okay. Thank you. Board members, any questions, concerns before they leave? Bill, John, thank you once again. It's been a pleasure to work with you both, and we are getting closer. Clay, we're getting closer. So thank you, Kelly.
Thank you.
As well. Perfect. That was 1 hour, just like what we thought it would be. And our next item on our workshop is our equity plan update. And I believe we have Anne-Marie Wren here. Is this a solo act today?
It is a solo act, but I brought people with me in case you have
any. You have backups. Backups in the audience. All right.
Always
all
good.
All right. I see. Before you start, Anne-Marie, I should have said this before. Board members, you okay? Anybody need a break? Everybody good? All right. Okay, Anne-Marie, whenever you're ready, just introduce yourself and your title, please.
My name is Anne-Marie Wren. I'm your Equity and Compliance Officer. And good morning, Chairman Persis, school board members, Mr. Egner. Each year, our district is required by Florida statute to submit an update to our annual equity plan, and that report is submitted to the Florida Department of Education. And I believe you each have a copy of that report as well. The plan allows the Florida Department of Education to monitor and ensure the provisions of the Florida Educational Equity Act are adhered to and educational resources are equitably distributed. The plan evaluates 7 areas, and we're going to discuss some of those in this presentation. One area is student participation. Evaluates minority enrollment gaps in advanced courses when compared to white students. FDOE looks at the data over a 5-year period. Last year, the district made significant improvements in this area, especially when looking at enrollment in all Level 3 courses. Black enrollment percentages increased from 50% to 61%. Black male enrollment percentages increased from 45% to 55%. Hispanic enrollment increased from 55% to 61%. Hispanic male enrollment increased from 53% to 58%. And English language learners increased from 38% to 42% over a 3-year period. That's when they started tracking that data. Next, when looking at student participation in dual enrollment courses over a 5-year period, Black student enrollment increased from 3% to 4%. Black males increased from 1% to 2%. Hispanic enrollment increased from 3% to 5%. Hispanic male enrollment increased from 2% to 4%. And ELL students remained at 1% over a three-year period. Next, when looking at student participation in advanced placement, IB, and ACE courses, Black enrollment increased from 9% to 18%, so it doubled. Black males increased from 6% to 15%. Hispanic enrollment increased from 13% to 16%. Hispanic males increased from 11% to 13%. And ELL students increased from 4% to 6% over the three-year period. The next area, employment equity. The Florida Department of Education compares student demographics and employment data to look for underrepresentations for minority classes. When looking at the data for the 2018-19 school year, 16% of our student population was Black. When comparing that to employment, 15% of our district-level administrators were Black, 17% of our principals, 30% of our assistant principals, 10% of our teachers, and 16% of our guidance counselors. When looking at the data for Hispanic students and employees, 20% of our student population was Hispanic, 10% of our district-level administrators, 5% of our principals, 5.5% of our assistant principals, 8% of our teachers, and 7% of our guidance counselors were Hispanic. The last area I'd like to mention is gender equity in athletics. Last year, Mainland High School was in compliance with all of our equity components set forth in the Florida Educational Equity Act. All of our remaining high schools were in compliance with all components except for Component 1. And again, Component 1 states that our sports and levels of competition must effectively accommodate the interests and abilities of members of both sexes. So if you have a school that has 50% student population is female, then your student athletes have to be, the females have to be 50% or greater, if that makes sense, okay, to meet that component. And last, I brought some people from the different areas in case you had any questions, some individuals.
Thank you, Ms. Wren, for that. It's always good to get a snapshot of where we are and what the trends have been. So open it up to board members, and I see Ms. Wright, and then followed by Ms. Haynes.
So for student participation in AP, IB, and ACE, when you disaggregate that information, how many of African-American students actually take AP? What caused the jump? Is it the ACE, or did more students enroll in AP and IB?
I'd like to bring up Dr. Amy Hall.
Could you go back to that slide?
Yes.
Please state your name and your title. Thank you.
Yes, good morning. My name is Amy Hall. I'm your Director of Student Government Relations. So we're going to go back to that. So this incorporates all AP, IB, and ACE data, and we can disaggregate that out if you'd like to show specifically AP, ACE, and IB. We are seeing increases in this number for two reasons. One, we have increased ACE, so we're starting to see where we started that program a couple years ago. Those students are now actually rolling into the ACE course. A lot of them before were in pre-ACE, but now they're in ACE. So we're seeing an increase that way. And then, of course, last year we did have courses, students at Mainland that went into the AP course, so we're seeing those numbers increase as well.
Can you disaggregate that data and send it to the board, please?
Yes, for the previous school year?
Whatever the information is based on. So, yes, the previous school
last
year.
School year.
Last school year.
Okay, Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so my question is not about your PowerPoint presentation. It's about the information that's in the booklet because I was reading through all of it. So my first question is, you list individuals that are responsible for different things, and I knew who two of the individuals were, but I do not know who is the advanced program TOA.
We don't have an advanced program TOA. We have an advanced program coordinator. So at one point we did have a TOA, and under the reorg that position dismantled. So we now have one person, which is Mr. Rivera, who oversees all of the advanced programs. So in years past, we've had it to where AP, IB, and ACE were under Mr. Milholland and the TOA, and AVID was out with Mr. Beal, and now it's all under one house, as well as dual enrollment.
Okay, because that's throughout the whole thing, it talks about the advanced program TOA, the minority achievement specialist, who I knew who that was, and the AVID, you know, coordinator who I knew. So I just did not know. So for next year in this report, that information will change.
Correct.
And you'll reflect it as a coordinator. Mm-hmm. All right. In this booklet, on page number 39, and I'm just pointing this out because I don't, not that it was one of the things that you had to check whether or not you were in compliance with, but I feel that it's important and we need to take a step forward in it. Number 11, where it says increased social media presence, including messages in Spanish. You know, we're doing a great job of increasing things and everything, but a lot of it's being put out in English. Some of it has started being put out in Spanish, but I feel like we need to, when you look at our sheer numbers of students, that we need to get some more stuff out in Spanish. I know some schools do more of it themselves when they're sending it out, but that was one of the things that I felt. And then on the part on page, I think it's 36, where Mr. Egner had to sign off on the compliance piece.
Yes.
So the reason why we're not in compliance for number one, though, is because 50% or more of our girls are not.
Yes, and also they're very strict on which sports they consider for this report. Mm-hmm. So, like, the rowing that we're adding or we have added, we're still waiting to hear if they're going to consider that next year for this report. We have kind of been going back and forth with the competitive cheer and trying to get them to count those numbers as well. So they want to consider just your traditional sports, I should say, whereas a lot of our girls are participating in alternative-type sports now. So that's something we're kind of going back and forth with DOE and OCR on.
So maybe that's something to point out so that the public knows, so that because girls are involved, they're just not involved in sports that are being
played. Correct, absolutely.
Yeah, good points. Mr. Cologne.
Go ahead.
I'll get back to you, Ms. Wright.
If I could just add real quick.
Yes.
They're very strict on, DOE gives us a template on how to put this report together, so they're very strict on what we, but that is a very good point.
Maybe in your presence,
yes.
Like in the presentation, you could say, you know, we understand we're out of compliance with number one because DOE views number one as
only these sports.
Football, yeah. Basketball, you know, those types of things, and they're not counting these sports that girls are involved in.
Definitely. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Cologne.
So I asked a question, and just for the benefit of the rest of the board, about the numbers, and do we still anticipate seeing a 2% increase despite our change at one of our high schools? And the answer was yes, so I'm encouraged by that. But my question is, how are we going to accomplish that?
So I thought long and hard about your question, and actually it's something our department talked about this summer at length, and we decided that we weren't going to make any excuses and say we can't, our numbers are not going to increase because this happened, so we're not about excuses, we're about solutions. We're working very hard with each school to make sure they understand the students that would be potentially be successful in these types of courses and push them that way. We're continuing to add dual enrollment opportunities for students, although limited on campus, and that's a DSC concern, and we're working through with them. We're under our reorganization. We have taken all our advanced programs, all of our level 3 courses, AP, IB, ACE, and dual enrollment, and we put them under one house, and so that should be beneficial as well. We're working together rather than stepping on each other's toes, so I think that will help. So I'm optimistic and I'm hopeful, and we are going to work very hard to show an increase, but I'm also a realist, and I realize that there's a potential there because we have seen a shift in the way some practices at a particular school, we may see a decrease, but we're going to continue with the mission, and that's an increase of 2%. We're very excited about, and you'll see as you look over the last 5 years, we have progressively added each year a percentage. This was our biggest jump, and I am sure the story will be spun that it's one particular school, but that's not the case. It's a culmination of all 10 of our schools, and a lot of hard work happening even at the middle school level to prepare those students for level three coursework.
And again, I'm encouraged that you're accepting that challenge.
We are. We're ready. Let's do it.
You mentioned Daytona State, and, you know, they have a campus in Deltona, so, you know, I focus a lot on Deltona High and Pine Ridge. Have we, and I don't know the answer to this question, maybe Ms. Wright can help me. What is our relationship with Bethune-Cookman? I know at one time they tried to open up a campus in Deltona, and, you know, Daytona State is obviously an ally of ours, and we work very closely with them. But schools like Bethune-Cookman may attract more of the minorities into dual enrollment. Is that something that we have now? Is it available?
Right now, we do not. I know at the end of Dr. Jackson's tenure, maybe at the beginning of President Grimes, it was discontinued or severed. But with the new president at the helm, I'm sure it may be something he would probably reconsider.
We would definitely be interested in having those discussions. At one time, we had a very robust Bethune-Cookman relationship with dual enrollment, and that kind of fizzled out. And so we would love to have a conversation and offer other opportunities.
Yeah.
And you know, I think of there, and there may be another, you know, and again, I know there's Ana Torres, which is a university that's in Orlando, but they may also have that opportunity. So it's kind of like, you know, the opportunity to participate in dual enrollment with the folks that look like you, and that matters.
Mm-hmm.
So just a thought, and I think there's opportunity there. I know, again, with Bethune-Cookman, you know, at one point I thought, and this is before my time on the board, that, you know, it would be a great opportunity for both of us, actually, you know, maybe even be able to push in to the, you know, because, you know, even having Daytona State in town, students have to be able to make it there. And so do we have, again, I'm thinking out of the box, can we bring a professor to give the class or an online class or whatever the case may be to expand that? And I think that would be huge. I have a question probably for the superintendent in the absence of an HR director. As far as employees and diversity, and maybe you can answer this later, but what strategies are we doing to increase that as well? Last time I asked, you know, what were our strategies the year before as compared to what was being presented? And so I'm curious to hear what we're doing different from last year that we plan on doing next year to also increase that number as well. So you can get back to me on that.
Mr. Superintendent, you want to weigh in on it?
I would only be able to offer generalities, so I'd prefer to be able to speak to staff first before I answer.
Sure.
I appreciate that.
Makes Thank sense. You. And Ms. Wright, and then I'll get back to Ms. Cuthbert. Yes.
So I just want to go back to the report. The report each year has been a point of contention for me, because each year we keep seeing the same issues. And we knew last year it was sports and girls. Mm-hmm. We know this year, we knew 3 years ago. And we know diversity is an issue. Mm-hmm. And I guarantee you when we receive this report next year, the numbers are going to be lower. Because even with our restructuring, it was pretty much all whites, I'm sorry, that were promoted. No diversity. And so when we say as a district, our goal is to really start looking for Hispanics and African Americans. I don't see it. I don't see it. I haven't seen it in 6 years. We've never put an effort to really look from the cabinet down to really look for African Americans or Hispanics, and especially to Hispanics. I mean, for us to have almost 30% Hispanic and we only have 7, I'm concerned. This report looks the same every year. And it's just a little disheartening to me.
Sure. I get it. Ms. Cuthbert?
Congratulations to Mainland, who continues to are in compliance with the Equity Act. I would like to ask, from last year to this year, in girls and sports, has there been any increase or has it been a decrease? Are we moving in the right direction?
We are. A lot of our high schools just missed the mark. You know, and some of them, like Spruce Creek, has been in compliance in years past, and then they'll just miss the mark on that percentage for that component one. So a lot of them are very close. And if you look in the back of the report, I don't know if in the appendix, it gives each school that is not in compliance has to submit a corrective action plan. of what they're doing to correct that. And it also gives their numbers and their percentages based down by varsity and junior varsity, so the participation numbers.
Are cheerleaders considered in this?
We added them back in this year, the competitive cheer. I may get an email from FDOE saying we need to pull them out. We've provided some additional documentation that we feel helps our argument that it should be included.
I do believe those young ladies are, and yes. There are more and more young men who are involved in cheerleading.
Absolutely.
They are athletes. And I have another question. I have been, as a former advanced placement teacher, and knowing my community, as we increase availability for ACE for students, is our enrollment for AP decreasing as a result of ACE increasing?
We tend to pull the same students, the same clientele. So we are going to, as we take from one, you'll see one decline a little bit. So that's a possibility. When we break out those numbers by AP, IB, and ACE as requested, you're going to see, we did it again next year, a slight decline in AP for ACE or a slight decline in IB for ACE or vice versa. What we find is that students find their niche, and they'll go in a program that they feel is the most comfortable. The benefits, we have an IB program at DeLand. We have an IB program at Spruce Creek. We have ACE programs that are specific. There's AP sprinkled in all of our schools. So you will see students in the IB program that are also in the AP program. So it's not siloed as much when it comes to AP. So I think you'll still see an involvement in AP.
Okay. What do we do as a district to distinguish each program for students so that they know what's expected of them, the IB, what colleges look at and what careers look at? Would the construction industry prefer an A student or just completely ignore IB students? I mean, we want to be able to have our students be successful academically, but also be ready for all the career as well as college.
Absolutely. So we start with the high school. Well, actually, we start in middle school talking to students about what is AP, what is IB, what is ACE. These are all acronyms they've never heard before, and they sound very similar yet different. So we start with making sure that we educate our students and our parents so they can make a good educated decision of what course is best for their student. We talk about the differences between those programs. For instance, IB is a little bit more stringent, and it's students are kind of more boxed in a program, whereas an AP, if you're strong in science but not necessarily in language arts, you can pick and choose. So we kind of talk to students about those options. It's also a matter of geographic. So if I am zoned for Spruce Creek High School, there's not an ACE program at Spruce Creek. There is an IB program, so students would apply to that IB program. We do have dialogue with students, all students, about post-secondary opportunities, and we talk to them about colleges. Not every college will accept AP credit, depending on each school's difference. Some require a 5, some require a 3. Some will not take any AP credit. Same thing with IB and ACE. So we try to talk to students about the benefit of these programs at the high school level. And as they start thinking about post-secondary, absolutely this gets them ready for post-secondary. It makes them more marketable for post-secondary. But there are going to be situations where post-secondary is not going to take those credits. Mm-hmm. Those are dialogues that we continuously have with our students. As far as your question in regards to construction, I think these types of coursework, a rigorous content, helps to prepare all students. Whether you're looking for a field to go into post-secondary, if you're looking to go into the workforce, I think it gives students an opportunity to not only learn content, but then the application of that content.
And my last question, this is an equity plan, and I see where diversity and race and gender need to be addressed. But now, I haven't gone into great depth. I haven't gone page to page. But do we also go into socioeconomic disparity or diversity as well?
Not in this report, no.
Okay. It's not required then by the DOE?
No, it's not.
Do we address that at all? And as we include as we put forth, I do know the governor is working for workforce, 2030, and as we push our CTE programs, there's a difference between white-collar and blue-collar education as well as jobs. How are we addressing, or will we address at one time I guess, putting some emphasis of you, it doesn't matter what course you're taking or what economic background you are or what social group you hang out with, you can take either an IB course or an ag course. We tend to identify those kids take that course and those kids take that course. And that is somewhat a prejudicial viewpoint. Will we, as we approach our governor's workforce education strategies, is that something on our radar to help address that social economic prejudice or diversity?
Yes and no. So how we would get that information is through free and reduced lunch. So at the secondary level, that becomes a little limited because not everybody completes that paperwork that may qualify for that. So that kind of limits us. But what we do is cast a wider net and try to capture more people rather than narrowing it down just to our free and reduced lunch students. We utilize Nick Prince, who goes into our classrooms and does personal conversations with small groups of students about his journey and where he has come from and how he got involved in advanced programs. And so we're trying to reach students at their level. We're trying to go into the community and have those conversations and dialogues so they are aware of the opportunities and they are seeing someone that looks like them, that has lived in their neighborhood, that attends their church, and they're resonating with him and they're saying, okay, let's do this, we're ready. In addition, when it comes to our application process, Nick, Jose, myself are all involved in that as we look at those students that are making application, ensuring that there is an opportunity for students to be enrolled in these advanced courses.
And what it all boils down to is the personal touch.
Absolutely. It is about relationships. It really is.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Mr. Superintendent.
And I'm sorry for this, but I had a collection of comments that I've gathered as the discussion went on, because this is a very important topic. And I used to do the equity report in my previous district. And Volusia's looks very positive compared to many places. And I did want to discuss the whole issue of advanced academics and the degree to which you have to be very precise in trying to find the right fit for a student. I think Dr. Hall is very correct about that. And generally, there's kind of I would call it a profile of these programs. AP should be available everywhere, and you play to your strength. Most kids play to their strength. They choose a course one at a time, and then they're usually looking at something they want to do. Some will reach out and challenge that because they want to accumulate more AP courses. But that is the most flexible. That and dual enrollment. Then if you go into the canned programs, and I call them canned, and that's not a negative connotation, I could have said planned program, then you're going to be required to take X number of courses, probably in multiple content areas. ACE is more flexible than IB in that regard, but they're both canned in the sense that you have a profile you have to follow. That means those students have to make other choices, perhaps, in regard to electives or being involved in a CTE program or in dual enrollment. And that's where we get the hyper-involved kid who's taken 7 classes at the high school and 2 dual enrollments, and, you know, they're putting enough stress on themselves that you really have to watch that direction, too. You can overdo. So usually when you're advising a student, it has to do with their total profile. Are you trying to get them to enter into a level 3 or above course? Because every student should work to try to find one that works for them. And it may be in the arts, which is why it's so important to promote the arts, especially level 3 courses. And there's not a lot of them, but you can find them. There is an AP, IB, of course. And to work with those students to reach those goals and the support that's school-based for students who enter the program. The lower the threshold to get in, the larger the safety net. The higher the requirement, the smaller the safety net. So the district tries to find the sweet spot with the application process and encouragement to make that right. Having said that, if you were talking about your construction student, it's much more likely the student who's fully engaged in CTE would be taking a AP course or a dual enrolled course, as opposed to a CAN program, which might take 4, 5, 6, 7 courses to get through, plus additional requirements, though it's not exclusive. Scheduling is a big issue with that. If you're in this program, you can't schedule into the classes in this program. So all those factors have to be looked at. And as far as building students, I wanted to make two comments. When I spoke to the principals at the last institute on this topic, and we were talking about our increases in SAT scores and that it is a K-12 process. The high school that generates the SAT score is only able to do that because of the middle school that had the student and the elementary it started it. And most of these kids are built between third and fourth grade. And I don't think there's any more important message about building advancement than to say it's at elementary school where the building advancement begins. Because if they're typically identified getting out of third grade in the fourth as what potential they have. Then they go into middle school and they're either in the higher classes or not. That usually determines if they can get into the higher classes in high school. So their life projection for academics is determined between third and fourth grade, unless there's an intervention. And so finding that talent and intervening for someone who may have been at that stream and helping them get out is part of that fine-tuning of guidance, working with teachers who give recommendations, working with the district. Towards that end, I'd also reference that with CTE, we're trying to reform the application to give weighted points to that and begin pulling that away from, you know, just only a group of teachers making a decision about the kids in their school, but also weighting this. So we could give additional points for underrepresented groups and things of that nature, which is a process I'm used to doing. So it is a complicated process, and I did want to mention, because it wasn't referenced, is AVID is supposed to help build these students into that. So that's a specific targeted program that you identify students with potential and try to build them into level 3 courses and beyond. And, you know, that's been a direction that the district has had for quite some time. So whenever we talk about this and in the future when you talk about it, I hope we just don't start at the end. I hope we start where this begins and say, how do we build this from third, fourth grade to make sure that kids get adequately counseled and directed, supported to move in higher numbers into these systems. And if this is too much for student A, then maybe they'll try this. And if that's too much, then maybe they'll go one at a time. Even if we can only find one dual enrolled course or one AP course, that one could make a difference in their life. And the last thing I'd reference is the success of the strategy that was employed, and it does impact numbers. And I'll just pick two schools by example. The Seabreeze ACE program undoubtedly could cause an impact in the Spruce Creek IB program because the Seabreeze kids are staying where they would naturally stay at their zone school because now they have the, quote, planned or canned 4-year top academic program that was lacking before. Not that academics was lacking, but they had to put it together themselves in the AP offerings. Now they have a program, so there's no need to go somewhere else. So wherever, if we have a high-end program at every high school, then it is likely that program will prevent movement out of zone. Yeah. And that's a good thing because principals want to keep their own kids, but we want it to be a good thing for the kids because we don't want them to lose opportunity. So it's a win-win. You've got an opportunity, you stay at your zone school. And so that's the goal of part of this process, and it is showing fruit.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so also there was two other parts where I learned something and I had a few questions. So on page number 40 where you talk about the single-sex schools and classes.
Yes.
So I had never heard before of the True Core Behavior Solutions. I knew that we had programs with the juvenile justice. Is this a new title?
Yes. It used to be, gosh, what was the name of it prior to that? I can't think of Larry, Virginia? Oh, G4S. That's right.
Okay.
Couldn't think of it. They just renamed.
G4S is now true. All right. I know what G4S is. All right. Then my next thing was on page 49 when we talk about the pregnant and parenting students.
Yes.
In here, we state that they can receive district-supported child care at any licensed daycare of their choice and also receive school bus transportation for their babies under specific conditions. So do we have any students that are taking advantage of the daycare and or bus transportation other than Child's Academy? Like, do we have someone, a young lady that's pregnant that has chosen to stay at University High, as a sophomore, say, has her child, and we're providing the daycare for her?
My understanding is that, yes, we do, but I would have to clarify that with our coordinator over that program as to how many.
I would like information on that, if we have any data on that, because I did not know. I mean, I know all about Child's, and I have visited there, and I know how Child's came to be because we closed down a lot of our pregnant parents' centers at our high schools. So I did not know that if a young lady chose to stay at University High or DeLand or Pine Ridge or Seabreeze, that they had these things available. So I'd like to see data on how many students are taking advantage of this, and do we have anything that we share that tells them that they have this opportunity or that we have? Because to put in the report and say that we're doing it is one thing, but are we really doing it, and do they really know? That's, I guess, what I'm looking for.
Okay, so just to clarify, so you wanted to know how many are actually participating?
Right, and do we have some way, something that we give these
informs
them,
that
communicates to them and their parents that
got it.
We have this, it's an available thing? Because I've seen so many young ladies, especially on our west side of the county, struggle with this because they can't get to Child's. Like, Child's is doing a phenomenal job over here on the east side, but our west side students, I've noticed, can't get there. And so if they are staying on, I see a lot of them, unfortunately, staying home. And I don't want that to happen. You know, I want them to get their education. But how do we let them know that this is something that we offer? Because I didn't know we offered it.
We actually included in the report is a brochure as well as an excerpt, page 52 and 53, from our district website. And Amy might be able to speak to the guidance counselors and how they distribute this information.
So our school counselors, our secondary school counselors, are aware of this as an option for students. And so we provide them with a flyer and information. Certainly want to give them an opportunity to make a decision with their family, what's in the best interest for them. So we do provide them with this information. It's just discreet.
But I'd like some data then.
Sure. We can see around that. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Let me ask you, did you say that 20% of our school district's population was Hispanic?
Of our student population.
Student
population.
Those
were last year's numbers.
And did you say, what was it, what was the percentage from a black? Was it 16%? 16%. So I'm getting back to Ms. Wright's point about the underrepresentation, so forth, of employees, let's say, along those same lines. And I was trying to think, what is that percentage of teachers? Do we have it broken down by teachers or just employees?
Yes, let me go back to that slide for you. So when you look at our student population for African Americans, it's 16% for students.
Students, yeah.
15% of our district-level administrators were black, 17% of our principals, 30% of our assistant principals, 10% of our teachers, and 16% of our guidance counselors.
So 10% of our teachers.
Yes.
That's the figure I wanted to focus in on. And then for the other...
For
Hispanics, yes.
20% of our student population was Hispanic, 10% of our district-level administrators, 5% of our principals, 5.5% of our assistant principals, 8% of our teachers, and 7% of our guidance counselors.
Okay, so I want to focus in on just the teacher part because generally that's our pool of applicants when we are considering people for assistant principals and principals and so forth and so on. So I am hoping that if we, again, raise this base teacher salary pay, that more folks will decide to go into our profession. And then as we attract more, black students to pursue a career in education, as well as Hispanic students to pursue a field in education, then perhaps our pool of teachers will become, larger, from which we can take from that pool, to become assistant principals and principals and district administrators and superintendents and so forth. But we have to get them in. We have to get them into the, this field. And I know they have many other opportunities, and there's other jobs and careers that they can choose to go into that perhaps offer better salaries.
I think you'll see some positive changes with the general knowledge test changes that came down from recent legislation. So I think we're starting to see some trends come down from our state legislators, the change in general knowledge, the possible change in salary, which will hopefully attract more candidates for us.
Yeah, I would particularly like to see just more teachers that look like their students. I mean, that's what I really think is so powerful, and it's so it's proven to be a motivator for students too. So let's hope that happens. And Mr. Eggner has a comment.
Just a quick comment. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't point out the reality of the situation we faced the last few years, and that is one of the strongest strategies that I've personally used in trying to get greater diversity in the teaching or even in the administrative areas as well, was you advertised, and if you didn't get the candidates you wanted, you re-advertised. And then you might have to re-advertise again, and you might have to reach out in between, et cetera, et cetera. With the teacher situation as we have it now, with such a shortage, and I'm really supporting what your chairman is saying, we pretty much hire anyone who's qualified we can get when we can get them. Because if we said, well, let's hold out and re-advertise, not only will those people get hired, but you'll have a smaller pool, when you re-advertise because there weren't enough to begin with. And it puts you at a real disadvantage. So anytime you have a market like we have now, which, really is market forces are at work against us. One is the pay scale based on the budget, the district cost differential, and equity in funding. And then the shortage working against us on top of that means that a lot of the positive strategies you would normally use are put on a back burner because you're making a choice between is my priority greater equity or do I need to get a person in front of those kids day one? And so you usually go with trying to get a qualified person in front of the kids. So I would hope that once, if there is a change, if teaching does become more of a paid profession, especially for people entering, if that pool increases, then we would be back in the business of being able to apply better strategies to get the kind of equity that we should seek.
Yeah. Ms. Wright, I give you the final word here.
No, I'm going to let
Mr. Okay, Mr. Clone, go ahead. Get Mr. Clone, and then I'll give you the final word.
So I have a lot to say on this subject, and I've been very reserved, and I'll share that with the superintendent. But one thing that I realize is that here we're looking at students. And so Hispanic students, we've got 20%. However, Volusia County as a whole is only 13% Hispanic. So you can't and don't get me wrong, there's a lot of things we can do to strategies to get more Hispanic teachers, but the community itself doesn't reflect a 20% Hispanic base. For African Americans, and this is 2017 data, so it's pretty relevant, it's only 10.6% of the Volusia County demographics is actually African American. Now, again, I'll say it all, I could say it all day. I think that we need to put strategies in place as well. However, the reality is that you can't pull from what you don't have. And so this is counting children, and one home may have two, three children, but there's only one or two adults. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, and I'll say this out loud, I think that we're actually pretty mirroring our community, but we need to continuously implement things that will help to do that. Now, that's on the teacher conversation. The other aspects of this, we do have some control over. And I would never go to the level of saying, and I've lived this in South Florida in the 80s and 90s when the community was changing and representation was less, and it got really messy. But it's something that I think we may be able to have better conversations about the things that we do control moving forward. And that'll be a task in front of our, you know, for our new superintendent to find that diversity and move forward. Thank you.
Yeah, good point. Ms. Wright.
And you brought about a good point, but if I'm not mistaken, we have about 550,000 residents in Volusia County, about 550. Mm-hmm. So we're still not at 10% even of the population of Volusia County in either one of those categories.
Agreed.
So that is still concerning.
Yeah.
Because if we were 10% of the population, I probably wouldn't say too much, but we're not even at 10% of the overall population. I do believe teachers, I agree with you wholeheartedly. How do we attract more teachers? But I think once we solve the teacher issue, then the issue becomes how do you advance?
Yeah.
And I'm going to just be honest, it's been really hard, and I'm going to use the 30% for African Americans and 7% for the 5.5 Hispanic. They're normally always put in behavioral roles as assistant principal. They're not put in data. Mm-hmm. They're not put in curriculum. They're not put in positions as assistant principals that will make them well-rounded, or even if they change, they're always put in discipline. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about as a district, what we're going to do, I agree with you. We got to do things in the district that will propel them, because in order to be a principal, you can't only just focus on discipline.
No.
You got to understand data. You got to understand curriculum. And if I'm never given that opportunity, then quite naturally, when I become a principal, I'm going to have some major deficits that may prevent me from being successful.
Yeah.
So those are the kind of conversations we have to have.
Agreed.
All good points, and we thank you both for being here, and thank you for providing this information, and please follow through with the requests from the board members who asked you for specific data. Board members, do you want to take a five-minute break now?
Yes.
And then we'll have the financial report from Ms. Mueller, okay?
You're right.
We're going to reconvene our workshop at this time, and our next item of business is financial services. We have Ms. Deborah Mueller here, Chief Financial Officer. Good afternoon, almost.
I'm not sure.
We got like
but
a couple of
good
minutes.
Afternoon.
All right, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Persis, board members, and Mr. Eggner. I wanted to present some information to you regarding our internal audit plan and Auditor Selection Committee for fiscal year 2019-20. There are a couple of changes in legislation which really affect the audit and internal audit and the board requirements. So the first thing that happened was regarding school district accountability and an audit committee. So Section 218.391 Florida Statutes was meant to enhance governmental accountability in the audit processes, And a lot of this information came from the AG based on audit findings. They revised the membership of the Auditor Selection Committee to include the school board chairman and to exclude the chief financial officer from being on that Auditor Selection Committee. So we currently have a contract with Cherry Becker as our auditors, but we will have to meet eventually to choose a new auditor. We will do an RFP, but we also have an RFP out there currently for an internal auditor. So I'll talk about that in a minute. But the audit selection committee must be a member of the governing body and shall serve as the chair of that selection committee, as well as the chief executive officer or chief financial officer may not serve as a member of the auditor selection committee. So previously, I have not been involved in that process. It was purchasing, and it was Ms. Bertie Trawick, our finance director, but that is now in statute. The other area of school district accountability is regarding the internal auditor. So House Bill 1279 last year, 2018, actually amended Section 1001.4212.1 Florida statutes and said that effective July 1st of 2019 that school districts with revenues over $500 million are required to employ an internal auditor. And I have brought this information to you previously to discuss what we are planning on doing as far as meeting this requirement. So we currently have an RFP out there, as I mentioned, to contract with an external vendor that would be responsible for in ensuring that our audit plan, our internal audit plan, is developed and carried out, and that would be with the board's input and management's input. So the internal auditors under this responsibility are required to perform comprehensive risk assessments every 5 years and conduct other audits as the district school board directs to determine the adequacy of internal controls, compliance with applicable laws, the efficiency of operations, the reliability of financial records and reports, financial solvency, projected revenues and expenditures, and the rate of change in the ending fund balance. And I don't want to just read the statute to you, but I feel those are very important points and are specifically spelled out and added to the statute language. So that is the purpose of that. So what we would do is we have to perform risk assessments, assess the inherent risk in operations, and then prioritize the areas that you want addressed, and then have a strategy that we would use to then approve the audit plan and accomplish those tasks, and we would update that every year. Then it would also come before you for approval annually as an annual report. And I'm not going to go through each of these areas. These are the different steps in doing so. And again, once we have somebody that we are contracting with, then we would go through all of these areas. And this is just the draft. It would become more specific and tailored to the district. But the general risk areas that we find are the public, political, how is the district perceived, what's the tone at the top, strategic, how do we go about achieving our district goals and objectives, as well as analyzing the efficiency of district operations. We also have financial areas of risk, the financial reporting, financial stability, and viability of the district, as well as the safeguarding of all of our district assets. And then legally, we have risk, as you know, as exposures to lawsuits, legal challenges, And getting down to individual employees that they're complying with internal controls and procedures, and then also with that they're complying with external laws and regulations. So these are the special risk areas that would be included in the annual internal audit plan. And again, over 5 years, we're required to examine all of these areas. And, you know, we have a financial audit annually. We have an audit of internal accounts as well. But when the AG comes every 3 years, they also examine internal operations. And so that's what this is more in keeping with. You examine the operations of the district for efficiency, for proper controls, and reports would follow up with suggested enhancements and changes in processes that will make the district function more efficiently, as well as make sure that we're complying with laws. So as I said, the development of the 1920 plan, although I've drafted it to this point, and we did include this in our RFP release, it would be completed with the help of the internal auditor as well as the audit committee and district management. So as of right now, 2019-20, we have several outsourced audits. As I mentioned, our external auditors. We have the external audits of school internal accounts. We also have budgeted for a construction projects audit, and we are planning a human resources efficiency audit that will be completed this fiscal year. Another big area where an internal auditor would address would be to follow up on all of these audit recommendations as well. So that's ongoing. But also in the middle of the year, if something raises to your attention, then that would certainly become the subject of the internal auditor's focus as well, to carry out those directions. We do have some ongoing areas. We have continuing professional education and training. We have the principal intern program as well as the Volusia Leadership Academy. We train new managers in evaluating. We also have a fraud hotline, and we have we promote internal controls in our departments. So the recommendations and next steps, and these are really for your guidance and for your thought, and then to have input given back to me, because really this is going to be your audit committee. The committee, we have different options as to who it would report to. I'm compiling other districts, how that structure looks, and it varies from district to district. It could be reporting directly to you. It could report to the district audit committee as your designee. And so I would leave that final determination up to you. The internal audit RFP that was released, in September, and the proposals are due back in November. And then we'll have the evaluation team, and we'll need to finalize that contract after the selection during November and December. And then we would anticipate bringing that approval to the board for December or January. So that would be the timeline where we need to have this audit committee established and in place. We would want to draft an audit committee charter. And my recommendation, and again, this is just suggested, I will send out the compilation of what districts are doing so that you can, I'll send out a plan with some choices that you can then vote for which one you prefer. But I would we would first want to have an odd number, of course, of people, and we would want them to have a background of financial or business experience so that they are familiar with these types of audits. And if you would each like to appoint somebody, we can, you know, we can do that. Or if you want to sit as the chair of the audit committee, again, those types of things are up to you, and will be the decisions that you have to make. So once I forward that checklist to you and the options that we have, then you can respond. So I do need you, of course, to be thinking of those community members that may be willing and have the experience to serve. And if you have feedback now as far as what you'd like to see from a an appointment timeline, if I would recommend that they would coincide with the board members' appointment, you know, be rolling as we have for board members, so that they come on and off at the same time, whether you want them for a 2-year period or a 4-year period. Again, those are the types of decisions and conversation that you need to have. So, you know, if we can get your input, then I certainly will come back with further detail and recommendations to you.
So, Deb, thank you for that information. You're getting back to the statute. I see where it doesn't prohibit you or someone in the financial office from serving in an advisory capacity. Is
yes,
that correct?
That is correct.
And as far as when board members would need to make a decision in terms of appointing people to such committee, when would that have to be in place?
I think within the next month, if you can get those members to me, if those recommendations, then I think we, you know, obviously you want to have conversations with those people.
Okay, which leads me to the next question. When we are having conversations with those people, what is it that we need to be asking them to do in terms of a time commitment and time of day?
Yes. Obviously, going through RFPs, it depends on the number of responses that we receive. Those can be cumbersome, but they can also be read, you know, on their own time. They don't wouldn't necessarily have to read them during a meeting. They would come together to discuss those. Those meetings would take place in the sunshine, but they would be able to have the opportunity to read them. We receive them electronically as well as in print when we get them back. And purchasing would have training for those people as to how the process works. So they sit with each member either separately or together so that they understand the process.
And just to, again, clarify, the purpose of this committee, is it to select the company from the RFP that is out there now?
That is only one purpose. They would also be responsible for directing the internal audit, as well as, again, the internal auditor could determine to have them report directly to the audit committee, or they would report directly to you. So that would be, you know, you may want them, the internal auditor, to report to you. The internal auditor would definitely not report to a staff member. So it would either be the board or their designee, and I would suggest the audit committee. The internal auditor will have to meet at least 4 times during the year. I would recommend scheduling initially that number of meetings.
4 meetings
mm-hmm.
a year.
Mm-hmm.
and the time of day for those meetings?
That is to be determined. So, once we see the availability of the members, then we can certainly work with those schedules.
And, again, would you want board members to nominate people in November or December?
I would anticipate that by the end of November we would need to have their ability to determine and schedule those meetings as far as evaluating the audit proposals.
Okay, so I'm just trying to narrow down here on dates.
Yes.
So you think in the second board meeting in November would suffice?
Do we have a second board meeting in November?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I just threw that out. Out there. That was a test to see if you all were still listening.
I don't think there is. I know
an organization.
It's an organization. We do have the organization.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So then would it be December is too late, or is it? Okay.
Well, it depends on the number of
applicants,
the number of RFP responses, how long that will take, that process. But if you, if by the beginning of November you could get those to me, I think that would be the best timing.
Okay. Board members, I'm sure you have a couple of questions, so let me start with Ms. Cuthbert, then Ms. Haynes. Oh, go ahead.
This is an unfunded mandate.
Yes.
Yes? Okay. We have to hire an internal auditor, so it's a company. What kind of money are we talking about?
Well, when we were presenting the budget, we did include $100,000 for this purpose. And I know when we met earlier with the department budgets and staffing, we talked about that. We will have to maybe revisit next year as far as the hiring an external company. We recently found out that another school district actually was told by the AG that the statute says employees. And they're interpreting that in black and white as meaning that that has to be an employee of the district, the internal auditor. So we will have to revisit that. But, again, this is new language. It could go back before the legislature next year, and they could change it. And this was a district who has contracted their services for over 25 years with an external party.
So the company will get the money. What about our committee members? Is it voluntary?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so the company gets the money, but the people who are doing the work don't get anything.
Well, right? Well, the internal auditor will be doing work.
The work.
Yes. Okay. They will carry out our internal audit plan.
Okay, so the committee members are doing this on a volunteer basis.
They are.
Oh, goodness. No stipends or anything from that $100,000? Are they supposed to be voluntary?
Yes, they are supposed to be voluntary.
It's almost like our oversight committee.
Yes, correct.
Okay, I
correct.
And then we appoint that committee. Do we each have one, or is it five people, or is that determined?
That will be determined by the board collectively.
Goodness gracious. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wright.
And so that we're clear, it's not just the school system. It is for many nonprofit organizations that have to hire an internal auditor now.
Yes.
Not just school systems. It is for nonprofit.
Yeah. Yes, anyone with over $500 million.
Yes, for school districts specifically. Right. There were some that already had them. Mm-hmm. Some needed to expand their scope, and then some didn't have anything.
They're for profit.
Ms. Haynes.
Okay, so if you're looking at her recommendation and next steps slide, I think we have to first start with who's the board member that's going to serve on this, so that then we know who are the four that are left that are going to select a member, someone.
I think the board member talking would be a great chair for that.
So
but that.
I'm just trying to move the process to meet.
Well, again, this is not set in stone, the composition of the board, of the audit committee, I'm sorry. So that's one thing that I wanted you to be able to discuss your thoughts today as to what you would prefer.
My thoughts are,
go ahead.
if we're responsible for this, it should be one of us, okay, with four other people.
Right.
I don't see asking for five volunteers
telling
them that
they're
responsible.
In fact, I think it actually has to be one of us has to
be. Well, and you could have the entire board. There are districts that have the entire board functions as the audit committee, and then they also select members of the community. So, you know, you could do that as well.
Okay.
Ida has the most experience with accounting.
No, I have CPA, so I can always appoint a CPA to the board. So one of you can chair.
All right, so let's get back to we're going to come back in the first meeting in November with a name, right? Each board member has a name.
I think you have to do the first part because somebody's
going
to
say it was you.
Oh. Then, yeah, it was you. Everybody nodded their head on that. Didn't you see that?
Yeah, we're not voting. We know. We are saying it's you.
No, I was just trying to follow the
Come back with names for the first meeting. Everyone should have a name. Okay, everyone should have a name. And then if somebody else wants to be the chair, we'll figure that out on November. Any further questions for Ms. Muller?
Thank you,
Ms. Muller.
You are
Ms. Muller,
welcome.
Is that good?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate.
Sometimes I cut people off, and I don't mean to do that. All right.
I appreciate you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
And now we continue to move forward, and our next item is the half cent sales tax. Half cent sales tax project update.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman,
Good
members
morning.
Of the board. This will be a brief update for you.
Just state your name and title.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Sarah Lee Morrissey, Planning Director for the School District.
Greg Aiken, Chief Operating Officer.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sorry about that, too.
Yeah.
So this morning we just wanted to give you a brief update with our projects after summer and where we are. And I know that you have your Project Oversight Committee report. The annual report is on your agenda for tonight. And so I don't want to take anything away from them. So they'll talk to you about what we've been doing in the past year and certainly can speak to you on completed projects, as well as probably brief you on some of our statuses. So I just want to let you know that we are underway with abatement. We'll be done this week with the abatement on the remaining portion of the existing Chisholm, and we'll be proceeding with demolition. And then, of course, construction of the remaining part of the school. It should be ready for you next summer. George Marks, well underway, very pleased with the progress that we are making. Tough project, we've mentioned that before. What you see here in your photo is the first casting bed. To the left of your screen, behind the equipment truck, is the retaining wall. Remember, there's a significant amount of topography that we've had to work with. The site work on this project is intense, and certainly this summer's work speaks to that. On this casting bed, what happens is the tilt panel forms will be laid, and then you're going to start seeing the walls formed and the walls raised. So certainly next month, by Thanksgiving, you should see walls going up. Foundation work is happening now. Deltona Middle, we've been working on that, and I know I brought a revised site plan to the board in July. I wanted to advise the board that we've had the construction manager take a look at the revised plans. The cost estimate has gone up, largely due to the reconfiguration. One building, the classroom building, which is the tallest building in this view, will be on pilings. So they are getting close to finalizing construction documents. We'll be reviewing those, hopefully doing some value engineering with that, and then out to bid we go. Westside Elementary, not fully a half-cent project, mixed funding. We opened the new wing. Mr. Copeland, our new principal, walked in and saw he had a new building. In the top, as you look at the slide on your left, that is where the new cafeteria is under construction. And once we vacate the existing cafeteria, that will be turned into our special area spaces, art, music, skills lab. High school athletics, I know there's been some positive feedback on lights, both Atlantic High and University, and they both have had some home games this season. We've got track projects that have been completed. You're looking at the DeLand High. Pine Ridge was completed. Seabreeze, you probably have seen there's a change order on your agenda for tonight associated with Seabreeze's track. The underlying pavement condition, far worse than what was anticipated. But we'll be moving forward, hopefully, with that project after tonight. We've received some positive feedback on Media Center retrofits. Completed DeLand High, that's the slide on your left. Ventured into elementary schools this summer. First elementary school that we've touched, Palm Terrace. Mm-hmm. And I think that project itself has gotten a lot of positive feedback from faculty as well as our kids. Sometimes the work looks really simple, and this wand does not work. It doesn't. I do this to him all the time, but it doesn't work. There's a lot of people that it takes. I have with me Tom Brown, our coordinator of construction, one of our project managers. Paul Martino's here with us today. But I also have a few people in what we call the accountability division. And you don't get to see them, but they work very, very hard. And as we start getting into larger projects, and I mean your $100 million bond that we're moving forward on, there is a lot of paperwork associated with it. And just to give you an example, a pay app on a project like George Marks can be upwards past 50 pages. That's just one pay app. And it's a member of my staff that has to go through it line by line. Our project managers take a first look at it, but it's the accountability staff that's making sure things are reconciling and that we're paying for what we were received, and it's a lot of work. The accountability staff is also responsible for working with the project managers and the construction managers on owner direct savings. That's where we're purchasing. You see those change orders on your agenda regularly. You see it as a deduct, right, because it's coming out of the contract. We are purchasing the materials. And then those materials go to the construction site direct. We're saving sales tax. To date, and this reflects all projects, not just half cent, but to date, since we've had a more robust building program, the board has saved more than $1 million in sales tax. So you can anticipate over the next 5 years as you undergo a bigger volume of work that will increase. And that's your update.
To your point, though, on that saving the sales tax, but that's also extra work on somebody's behalf.
And that's why I wanted to have a slide.
Coordinating everything, and, there's all sorts of issues when you order anything and having it delivered on time, safely, who's going to be there to check it in. I mean, a lot of coordination involved. So I just want to give a shout-out to all those people who are ensuring that happens correctly.
I really appreciate you recognizing that, Mr. Persis.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely, because that savings then goes back into we can use other projects or get other projects completed. Really helps us as a district as a whole.
Yeah.
So not all change orders are bad.
Board members, questions? Anybody have anything? I don't see any hands going up. But, half a hand. Here we go. Ms. Cuthbert.
Half a hand.
Being around, people are so happy with Pearson Elementary. They're thrilled with Chisholm Elementary. Your department has just been exquisite, especially I'm thrilled with my steps at New Smyrna High. And looking forward to the construction project at New Smyrna Middle. George Marks being involved in selecting the architect and the construction company. And it's fabulous to watch it grow. And I went by Chisholm just yesterday morning, and I saw half of the demolition already. And I do know that the gym is going to be demolished
soon. We've had lots of conversation about that.
That is quite a loss to the community because it's utilized so very much. But I'm delighted that the city of New Smyrna has the Babe James Center, which will be used as well. So I have heard just wonderful accolades, and I said, call Sarah Lee Morrissey, call Mr. Aiken, call Mr. Young, and thank them because they're the unsung heroes.
Yeah, let me, I failed to mention some ongoing future things that you'll be hearing about. With George Marks, we initiated a rezoning over a year ago. And during the meetings with the community, as well as correspondence, we advised that we would not move forward on that until the school was under construction, because the intent is to bring to you a recommendation that indicates the effective date is when the new school opens. So we will be doing another community meeting now that we're well underway with construction. We'll be doing the same meeting we did, same sort of communication with the schools and the affected community. And then bringing that forward, I anticipate that will come forward to you early part of 2020. And then the other piece to speak to some of what you were talking about, Mrs. Cuthbert, out on the streets right now is the RFQ for Osceola Master Plan as well as New Smyrna Beach Middle School campus-wide HVAC.
Amazing.
And we invite any board member, if you want to do a tour during the construction projects at any point in time, just let myself know. We'll get with Sarah Lee and Tom Brown, and we'll be able to walk you through different phases as the schools are getting built. Or if you want to come see HVAC, chiller unit going in, just let me know. We can do that as well. Next topic.
Ms. Wright.
Just quickly, when will the abatement be finished?
It's supposed to be finished this week.
Friday.
Okay. Ooh. Is that quick enough for you? Mm-hmm. Okay, that's good. All right.
It's taking less time than we allocated, so we're happy about that.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, Ms. Cuthbert?
And one other thing, a promise kept. Mrs. Morrissey asked me before we started the building of Pearson what my vision was as part of the selection committee, what I wanted to see with our new schools. And I had two requirements, and she's kept her promise with each one. And I said, and the district, we agreed to this. We wanted community schools. We wanted our schools to fit the community and to fit the acreage in which it sits upon and not have cookie-cutter schools like Atlantic and Pine Ridge look identical. Citrus Grove and Cypress Creek look identical. And also, we both agreed we wanted color. And if Pearson and Chisholm doesn't tell you we have color in our elementary schools, it just splashes with fabulous, bright colors. So I want to say thank you very
lots
much.
Of positive, lots of positive on the colors from all of the students are loving the brightness and the bang as you go around that campus.
Great.
Both schools. Inside and outside.
Correct. So let me do this. So it's going to work. Okay, Queen Sarah, you're good.
Ah, okay. Okay, I'm sure.
Thank you very much.
Okay, just want to give a shout out to Paul Martino sitting back there, and to Tom Brown, two of our esteemed project managers, and the super work that they do as a former principal, and just having worked with so many project managers on a variety of projects that
seven different schools, if I think back, you don't realize how detailed their work is, and they are our eyes and ears, and they're protecting us, the school board, from things not being constructed in an unsafe way, you know, things being conducted on time, weekly meetings. It's just so much work that they do, and I'm leading up to not that they're getting any younger yet, you understand, but we have a lot of work that is going to be coming, and I mean a lot of work, a lot more schools to build and so forth. Are you in a position now where you're going to be looking to add more project managers, or how do you see that? Because I don't want to see the work delayed because we don't have the project managers to oversee the projects, and yet I also know you can't overload a project manager because that doesn't work either. So.
You've hit on a couple of key points. It's not just the number of people you have. It's their abilities.
Yeah.
And the work is challenging, complex, and I appreciate you recognizing that we may have a higher than average age in the department.
Did I say that?
I don't think I said that.
Myself included. And we're very conscious of that. And very pleased that a very recent hire, a young woman, came to us from out of state. So we are very much looking at how to bring in new, younger, to train, to ensure that the quality that you talk about, Mr. Persis, remains with the department, and that our seasoned project managers are able to provide that training. We are very fortunate at the moment. We have one of our veteran project managers, Mr. Fancher, who is our roofing specialist and has been with us for over 30 years, and he is retiring in January.
Yikes.
And so we took one of the vacancies and have a new project manager that's with us who is being trained by Mr. Fancher to become our roofing specialist. So we are working hard to fill gaps, recognize succession planning where we can, and also review the appropriate level of staffing. And so we still have a couple of things that we need to do to get ready for the new projects, the bonding, but we're almost there. We're close. We're almost there.
There's another department too, which is our building inspection department. Eugene Johnson, or Chip Johnson, and his staff. That these guys do a great job, but every project gets permitted, right? And so, and they also go back in and inspect to make sure that it meets the designs and the drawings. So, and like Ms. Morrissey said a few minutes ago, we're really looking there as well. We're looking there as well that we need some additional staff there to make sure that we work. These guys work. I know we normally off and schools are closed for 2 weeks during winter break. These guys are still working.
Yeah.
They still got to do inspections. They still got to do the meetings. They're still doing what they need to do. So, you know, unsung heroes. You mentioned that, and I do appreciate definitely piggyback off of what she said. That's definitely behind the scenes, lots of people.
Yeah. So, when is David's last day? When?
It's in January.
Right.
I don't know the exact date.
Certainly would like for you to bring him to a board meeting before he leaves, so we can express our appreciation. He has so many stories. I can't imagine the number of stories he has.
Oh, I'm sure.
With roofs. Yeah. Oh my goodness.
Said he's gonna write a book. No.
I think we all want to write a book.
He's a great guy too. All of you are. Any other questions for these two individuals? Okay, well then we thank you.
Thank you.
Greg, are you staying?
Yes, Shirley staying.
Oh, you're both staying. Okay.
I'm just gonna.
All right, so let's just move on then to our next and final item, mechanical systems update.
So good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And before you start, let me just say on behalf of the board, I know we appreciate the is it weekly reports
we do,
you send out? AC,
I'm behind.
AC updates or whatever it is.
I'm a little bit behind my email,
well,
so I'm going to apologize because I have the weekly major and minor.
I mean that's projects. A lot of work just to generate the emails.
Well, we track it all, too, so you know, we're tracking lots of things as well. So,
well, thank you for that.
So, Chairman Persis, board members, Mr. Eggener, thank you for this opportunity. Greg Aiken, Chief Operating Officer. To my left is Sarah Lee Morsi. And then to my right is Dave Bledo and Ron Young, the director, assistant director, here for the presentation this morning. There are several different comments and different things that we look at, and one of the things we want to talk about today is the mechanical HVAC and control systems, and we're going to briefly go through this, and if you don't mind, holding the question to the end, and we'll answer all of those questions. These guys are experts in the field, so we'll kind of go from there.
You
I know
have
we have some time.
17 minutes. Go
that's
ahead.
What I'm thinking. So that's so I'm going to hold my comments. And you guys, I'm sure you've already read all of this. So next slide.
Yes.
District has basically, we can break it into two separate groups, our DX and split systems, and we have chilled water systems. And so that's kind of like what we look at when we have a hybrid system. You can look at the pros and cons in the systems that we currently have there now. Systems choices that we currently have available. You're on a different slide than I am. There we go. Is the influencing factors that we currently have is the code requirements, the footprint, the design. For example, a good example is George Marks, what kind of system we're going to be putting in there because of the elevation changes. So what we can do there, obviously looking at the cost savings, so we got to look at that, and also how we can manage that from an energy management standpoint. Our goal is going to be to better anticipate failures in advance, ensuring all proactive measures, which would be our PMs, are completed in a timely manner with appropriate staff. And like I mentioned earlier, we're actually going to look at a hybrid system. We're going to use chillers where needed and DX systems where needed. So it's a blend between the two systems. So what we look at is today, technology, we kind of look at the need for humidity and indoor air quality and from an energy management standpoint. And I want to reiterate this. We do not shut off AC units. What we do is we set back AC units. And then we have humidity control systems put in place. So if the humidity rises above 55%, then the humidity, the AC kicks in to bring that humidity back down. So our set points are basically anywhere between 78 and 82 degrees. So, for example, the media center, and these guys can talk more about that than me, we may have that at 78, but we have other areas that are 82 degrees. So I know we had some concerns about mold. And the best way to control humidity is with chillers. But we talk about mold. And so when you look at mold, there are basically three things that mold needs. Number one is moisture. So you have to have moisture. Where do you get that from? Humidity could be one of those, condensation or water leak somewhere, right? And then it sits for a while. And the temperature range is 32 to 95 degrees is where mold can grow. So and also needs a food source. It's got to be on something or in something to grow. Right, and there are different types of molds and different issues. So we have surface mold, and then we've got internal or wall mold that connects from external leakage that we have. Anytime we have any mold issues that are out there, we have our environmental guys go by and do the analysis on that and take care of that. The majority that we see, correct me if I'm wrong, is normally surface mold, right? And we have mold everywhere. Even in here today, we have mold that's here today. So. This simply, from the setback standpoint, mold is not just going to grow because we're setting back the temperatures. We're actually doing the humidity control and looking at humidity, dehumidizing the
just because room. This is such an important point,
sure.
And we've all talked about it, and, mm-hmm. and the community does all as well. So the humidity factor mm-hmm. in the room, that's what generates really when that thermostat, I mean, when that chiller comes on. So if your set point, let's say, is 82 mm-hmm. and the humidity factor starts to rise above 55, mm-hmm. does that
then
automatically
it
trigger
it
even if the room temperature was only 78?
Yeah, humidity is a huge factor. So
okay.
just like my home, for example, have you ever seen during the wintertime you get the moisture on inside your
sure.
windows? That's humidity. So it's the moisture inside your home is actually causing that. That can cause mold. So what we're trying to do with our systems is to prevent that water accumulation on our windows, which would cause mold down the line. Humidity is the most common factor in hot temperatures like us in Florida.
Thank you.
And I'm sure he can get into the details. He's an environmental guy, too. Next slide. So what our current issues are right now that we're faced with our mechanical and control systems, if you think about, we have over 44,000 air conditioning units that are out there that we have to service every day, and I've got a couple slides on that in a few minutes. So we start looking at some breakdown, things that can break down. There's millions of parts that can actually break either on a chilled unit or a DX unit, like your home unit. So they are very complicated and proprietary systems that are there currently right now. There, like I mentioned, many components, the regular maintenance and equipment that's required for our staff just to go to maintain the systems is huge. And there's different comfort levels that people want, right? Some people get hot here. We got to set it to where we can save some money but also make it comfortable for our students and our staff to be able to work from there. One of the biggest things that we have that causes some systems failure is lightning strikes or power surges or power outages. So once when it gets zapped and it goes down, if it hits the control systems or any of those things, we try to bring back up, we have issues there. And that's what we see a lot of. And then we come back out and fix them fairly quick and get back on the road. Within the facility department, overall reduction in maintenance staff over from 2007 to current is a major issue for us. I think currently right now, correct me if I'm wrong, we still have 7 or 8 HVAC guys that are vacancies. So it's more than that now. We may have 8 or 9 currently right now. We have 14 that actually we have district-wide to work on these systems. We had to eliminate some of our training that we had back in the day. We're trying to bring that currently back right now with all of our trades, not just HVAC. Inadequate pay. An HVAC guy currently right now can make a lot more money outside than in-house. And I did send to you this morning, because I'm catching up on my emails, the pay scale for all of my trades and facility maintenance. So you have that to look forward to during the break. And then we have the oversight of extended warranties, and we started in 2013 with a 10-year warranty system on any new chiller units that we're putting back in now. So we're starting to look at the warranty and have an extended warranty and work on those as well. And then we want an oversight after we put a new system in for a year where the maintenance department and my Tom Brown's group actually oversee and manage that that HVAC system, a cooling system that is there right now. Next slide. So what is needed? And I think that's going to be key for us, is what is needed for us. I'm going to find that slide.
That's it.
My backup one. There you go.
Oh, no.
No, let me see.
I know.
Sorry. Excuse me. What is needed? All right, so what is needed? So it's sort of like this one here. So what we're looking at, yeah. So there we go. Thank you. So I'm not going to read the stuff on the right, but what we're looking at is 27,483 systems that are currently there and required man hours, and I think that's huge, 34,300 man hours required just to do PM work, just on the systems to keep them maintaining. Like your home unit, you have your guys come in to do the annual maintenance before winter and before summer. This is what we're doing monthly. We're going out there doing these systems in summer 60-day and summer annual inspections and those type of things. So lots of man hours that we currently have there today. Next slide. So what's happening currently right now? We have from 2007 to 2019, we actually have some issues there. The main thing is reduced workforce. We have increased square footage that we currently have to maintain right now with a reduced force. Loss of experience, definitely. You know, we just talked about people retiring. That expertise is leaving. We don't have any. I think Ms. Cuthbert mentioned it earlier to me, but also to you, is that our workforce is well experienced. And looking forward to retirement soon, and so we have to start attracting some of our younger staff out there now. And our systems today are more complex because of technology. So everything's kind of our systems are tied to technology today. Mm. Next slide. So our recommendations. So we looked at redundancy is a big thing for us. Larger systems cover more spaces. We understand that, and bigger, and if that system fails, it's a larger area or larger population that actually has some issues. So we have to have some sort of redundancy system in place so we can eliminate the larger failure, so we don't have to move lots of students out of their academic area. But it will cost us some upfront capital costs upfront to be able to put these redundant systems in place, and we are exploring that currently right now. Partial runs, right sizing chiller units or hybrid systems, whether the DX units is going to be critical as well to cool during peak times for us. Assisting energy management, we got to look at our costs. Right now, we're just shy of $1 million a month in the utility bill. That's huge. So how can we bring that cost down? And we have different things we can look at, LED lights. But energy management is one of those with our HVAC. And then new chiller units not implemented in facilities needs can be simplified if we use DX units in some cases as well. So next continued recommendations is energy management bypass systems. Currently in manual mode, we don't have any control over that, so they can control what they need to do. Adds another layer of complexity for us. Inability to use properly and maintain adverse impact when problems in our systems arise. So if a system, the control system fails, the unit could be good, but then we have to figure out how we're going to fix this problem. And we bypass to be able to turn the chiller unit on. When we say we have a chiller unit fail, it's not the chiller unit failing. It's normally the systems that fail. Something on the system failed to get it to cool where we need to get to. Construction division is exploring these options to make sure they're viable. I already kind of mentioned about the warranty a little bit there, 10 years since 2013. And then for 1 year, we're going to have them mirror each other as we go through, looking at some professional development, and we're also looking at quality assurance project supervisor is needed, and a systems warranty manager is also needed so we can start managing this properly. So next slide is about maintenance. And so training program, Mr. Young and I and Mr. Belletto have talked about with Tom Brown's group, looking at providing the training needed with our HVAC guys. Currently right now we have a major project that also is going to come in place, and we're going to have select staff go in there to be trained as it's being installed and start learning this system a little bit more. And ongoing training is going to be critical, not only in just HVAC but in all of our trades to be able to bring our staff up where we need them to be. Pay is obviously one of those things we're going to have to look at, and I appreciate Ms. Cuthbert asking for the pay scale for each one of my staff that are in facility maintenance, and so take a look at that. We are going to compare it to outside what they're getting paid there, and you can see the difference between those. And then quality assurance. One of the things that I know Mr. Young is really focused on since he took over as the director is PM and quality assurance to make sure that when we go in to do the PM on those equipment, any equipment, that is done properly and is done on time. And therefore, we can extend the life from cradle to grave on any system we currently have. Yeah, so, you know, proactive measures continue to be a primary focus for us, and we want to be more proactive than reactive. But see, here it seems like, and if you're the one school or the one classroom teacher or the one person that the AC goes down, it's a number one priority. I get it, right? But when we start looking at the failure rate of how many units we have compared to how many we have failed in a day, it's 0.0002% now. Wow. That's what the failure rate is. Very, very, very low. So we put it in perspective. We understand it. There are two things that are high priority. Safety, student safety is high priority for maintenance, and also air conditioning is a high priority for us currently now living in Florida. So we want to make sure that the system is working so we don't impact the academic day. We need a sufficient workforce. We need to start looking at increasing our workforce and the pay that goes along with that so we can maintain these complicated systems. And not spend the money outside to bring a vendor back in to repair these systems. And then we need to just make sure that we continue on with looking at the hybrid system and what we need and the systems that we have placed in per square footage. So now it's question time.
That's question time. Ms.
Wright. I try to go quickly. So.
Ms. Wright, yep,
you
got
4 minutes.
You did great.
Mine is 2 seconds. Okay. So all of the machines or all of the equipment we're buying, is it under the same manufacturer? So now that So why not?
So, yeah, if you want to answer that. Yeah, sure you can. So the new systems, you asked about new systems. So I'm going to let Sarah later on can actually answer it as well. They're not all the same, so we don't standardize.
Well, I understand the point. The point is standardization. But we never want to sole source because there's always a problem with sole sourcing. And there, we've run into issues where for a period of time, you know, a certain, and I really don't want to name manufacturers and or vendors, they do very well, and then all of a sudden things are failing. And I don't think it's wise to become 100% dependent on any one source. Ron, you would...
I wouldn't say, district size, I wouldn't say 100%. But I don't think we should have more than four options because that's where our leveraging come in. Mm-hmm. So now we're losing leveraging when we have six or seven different companies. Yeah. But, I mean, that.
You're right. The problem with having too many options in the field is we have mechanics in the private sector that spend their entire lives working on train or their entire lives
one
working
system.
On carrier. And they'll spend their entire lives working on DX. And they're constantly learning. They'll spend their entire lives working on chillers, and they're constantly learning. We're asking our guys that make $13.77 an hour to work on all those different systems, chillers, ice machines, DX units, mini splits, and energy management. And in the private sector, like I said, those people focus in on one of those areas. But we ask our people to work on all.
So it goes back Ms. to maybe getting a smaller pool.
We have three.
Three?
Okay. Three that we work with.
Mr. Colon.
So what are the challenges? I recently learned of a district that got rid of their high school diploma requirement for some of the trades. Obviously, our pay is low. I mean, there's no doubt about it, and we rely on these HVAC guys. What are the obstacles or the things that stand in the way? For example, criminal past. You know, you were in trouble when you were 17. You're now 50. You've led a wonderful life, mm-hmm. yet we exclude you because you got in trouble when you were. Are those kinds of things obstacles for us right now to get this workforce?
I'm going to say yes, sir, and I think they can answer that as well. It is. And so I think there's a couple of things. That's not just one that you point out, but that is one of those. So like you said, a young man in his late teens, early 20s, was smoking pot or something like that, and now he's trying to get a job 20 years later. We go back. If it's a felony type thing, we don't hire them. Other school districts do, but we don't on certain things. So that is something for us. The amount of time it takes for us to hire a person going through the HR process takes a lot of time. When somebody's looking for a job, so they got to fork out the fingerprint and drug testing money to come up to get hired with us, as well as another complication for us. Mm-hmm. And then the salary, obviously, is one of those that, you know, we need to kind of look at as well, try to get competitive with our partners outside so we can bring on some quality people here.
So is that HR policy, is that, and I don't know the answer to the question, is that school board policy or HR district policy?
So Florida, I think each, I understand where you're coming from. So I'm not sure on the years of experience is another area that we have an issue with right now. We can only bring in 5 years, and some of the people we're trying to attract, they've already worked in the field for many years. They just want a retirement at some point in time that has a little money back in their pocket when they retire. That's another issue. We don't give them the years of experience that they have, 10, 15, 20 years. We only give them five. So it's complicated, and that's a union, that's a negotiation item that we're trying to get over that to bring in 10 years. To answer your question, Florida statute has some things that are disqualifiers for being employed here. Some are in gray areas, and I think some of those gray areas are the ones that I think we need to look at from an operational standpoint to be able to say, yeah, we need to do that.
And so, you know, part of the reason why I say that is having sat on the Florida Board of Respiratory Care, you mm-hmm. could have had somebody who had gotten in trouble, and they go through respiratory therapy program. They have to come before the board because they do have a criminal past. We're given all of their information, police reports, et cetera, and then we make a determination if that individual is safe to practice in the state of Florida, and we would issue a license as such. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I don't know if that's school board policy or it is our
some of it is. As Mr. Aiken referenced, the state does have a list of what I would call the unforgivable sins, and you can't hire if anyone has that on their record. We have an area where we went beyond that, and we went beyond that to protect the board, because you know how responsible you're held, even when you had a substitute who was here, who was cleared for hiring, then went on to commit a crime. The whole world came back and said, how did that person become a substitute? So trying to find the balance between protecting kids, protecting you, and finding the people we need to hire is difficult. I started addressing some of these things in the gray area with individual meetings with the people who very much fell into the description that Mr. Aiken gave. One of them was an individual who wanted to work in this department who committed an act in 1975 and has since then been a stellar citizen. So I would clear them one at a time based on that profile, but only after some type of an interview, because I don't want to get flippant about it, because then you'll pay the price or someone will pay the price if we make a bad decision. I would highly recommend that with the new HR director and the audit that will follow, that the notion of being able to strip down anything that we're requiring that's not required by law, and then reviewing only the things we think that are essential to add to that, with an appeals process that's very much like what I'm doing on an individual basis now, but institutionalize it, would assist. I'm also glad that Mr. Aiken did reference a lot of what we're talking about today is part of collective bargaining. And it always seems like when these discussions occur, whether with teachers or anybody else, that it's all about our side. And you have to understand that collective bargaining is just that, it's collective. So persuasion to make some of these changes, because whatever you do with one person may negatively impact another. And I will try to pick an example that isn't even referencing this, but take an example of raising the base teacher pay. Mm-hmm. You've already got people making noise about, well, what if I've taught for 10 years? I don't want someone coming in and only making $2,000 less than I did. I've been here for 10 years. So you start taking workers in these categories and saying, this one will pay more, this one will pay less, this one will pay more. You're going to get kickback from the collective bargaining position, because now you're picking winners and you're picking losers. And the argument, well, availability, this and that and the other thing, is tough. But I think it's a direction we have to go. But be aware, it's not something I could decide or Mr. Aiken could decide or even you could decide. It has to be collectively bargained.
Right.
And then you mentioned the finger. So how much is the cost? So I come in. I'm an HVAC person. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make $13 an hour. You agree to hire me. Mm-hmm. Now I have to go pay. Mm-hmm. How much is that money to do the background check and the fingerprints?
Yeah, so the fingerprint, don't hold me to the exact amount, but I think it's $49.50, and I think the drug testing is just $25, just shy of $26. So you're looking at just shy of $100 to fork out to be able to just to get that step done. And then we got to go. Then we get to hire you once when the checks come in place. The other part of that is validating years of experience. I personally feel that these guys that work in the field know you could validate as experience in that field to give them the years of experience to get up to level five. Right now, it's all done in HR through validating, through the employee sending off a reference saying, coming back, yeah, he worked for me, and he did these things, to get the years of experience. I think that needs to be looked at, and I think it's one of the things Mr. Egner mentioned, that we need to kind of start looking at those things, bring it back to us, let us validate the years of experience, and then put it back in. So, up to five right now, that is negotiable.
And so we run into that in the hospital. You have folks who are medics who can save somebody's life in a parachute on their way down, yet they come into civilian life and it doesn't translate. Mm-hmm. Is that the case also for experience? I mean, how do we look at that?
So currently right now I have one employee that's in the Air Force Reserve that has been through training extensive training, military training in the trade that he's actually working for us with, and that experience that he has, and he goes, you know, a weekend every month and 2 months out of the year, and none of that counts towards his years of experience to give him a higher pay. And I think we need to start looking at some of that and say it needs to count.
Yeah.
Anytime you go and you go through, you know, 700 hours of extensive training and you're working that in that trade, we need to count that in the military, is my opinion.
I appreciate what you said, Mr. Egner, about, you know, there are going to be some union members that push back. But if we don't start somewhere, we're never going to start. So, you know, Greg mentioned doing a gap analysis on the minimum salary versus the maximum salary when you come in. But there's other gap analysis that we need to do in the district. You know, we concentrate so much on the kids making straight A's and going to college, and I did the exact same thing. I pressured my kids to play the sports and make straight A's and go to college and make straight A's in college. But there's a group of kids, you know, I coach baseball. Last year was my last year. I mentor now. I dealt on a high with the boys. And I worry about those boys and what they're going to do after high school. Some of them are not going to college. Some of them should go into the trade. Some of them have interest to go into the trade. I would like to see, personally, grow your own. Have a more robust CTE program where those kids can be grown into these jobs.
And one of the things, since you looked at me and said that.
So there you go.
Here we go.
I had written down grow your own.
Yeah.
Early on in this discussion, because that is a very important part of this. Mm-hmm. And at a recent district advisory committee meeting at Deltona High School, we had a presentation on CTE to the audience. And we started referencing our 41 CTE programs. And then there was discussion about what was the largest problem with it. And the largest problem is marketing. Mm-hmm. It is convincing not just the students but their parents, mm-hmm, that these CTE tracks lead to real jobs, lifelong jobs, jobs that often come with benefits, working for people who still offer benefits, which a lot of places do not. And all that has to be factored into their life trajectory decision, and that making that decision to start one of these programs doesn't mean they're locked into it. If they have a change of heart, they can have a change of heart. It's not forever. So I would contend that not only do we have to do a statistical analysis, but we also have to do a marketing analysis in which we can popularize CTE options. And I always joke about other places where I came from. We did a partnership with the city for water treatment. Now, I bet you can imagine and count with no fingers how many kids enter school thinking, wow, I want to work at a water treatment plant, and, you know, and they aspire to this. But by setting up an academy for that purpose, marketing it, having the city help us with marketing, describing the benefits and the pay, and if you pass your C-level license, you can go to the next step. We empower and hire 11 different positions in this plant. You could be a chemist and work here as well as an operator. Suddenly you had to create a market. You had to create an interest, help people understand. And I think that is a place we are becoming much more aware of, mm-hmm, our weakness in marketing good options for kids to take advantage of not only the programs we have but the ones we may need to grow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, apprenticeship is one of the things we're kind of looking at, you know, bringing somebody in that's just out of high school and start teaching them one of our trades, whether it's carpentry, plumbing, electrical, or HVAC, and then start getting them into the schools is what we need to do, better marketing. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Cuthbert.
All the pay comes out of the capital budget, the capital projects.
General fund.
General
fund.
All comes out of the general
fund.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. We desperately need to improve that their pay, because it is a critical area. We do address critical area with our faculty members, critical area especially with skills level. It's very much needed. When I met with the New Smyrna Hub yesterday, there were three young people out of 25. Everyone else will be retiring 3 to 5 years. And it was because I recognized a lot of them, and it's, you know, from the years of being in the classroom.
That was a little zinger. But also one thing, too, as we have our CTE programs, a lot of kids are, for example, in engineering. They also need to take a construction class. Mm-hmm. That you have the schooling and the application, the learning and the application course. So if we could incorporate, if you're going to, into social justice, let's have, where are you going to apply that? Have an internship with, and almost every community has a some kind of adjunct courthouse or a lawyer. They have to serve so many hours with and apply the, what they're learning in the classroom. So it's important to have both, just mm-hmm. not the learning, but the application of that learning as well incorporated into the course. And I bet you we get a lot of community members involved with, oh, there's a potential hiree. Mm-hmm. If you can complete this, even if you get a certificate at Daytona State, a 1 year, a 2 year, or go 4 years at any local college, we'll guarantee you a job if you get back here.
Interesting statistics that I had is 56% of all those that enter college make it through. 44% do not, but they have debt, so they drop out at some point in time during their college career, but they have to find a job to pay back their debt. One of the other things, if we're looking for funding, maybe we want to start looking at or thinking about at one mil, and so we can offset our DCD that we're losing funding from, and that would help us on our salary piece.
Yes, we'll definitely talk about that
at a later time.
At a later time. That's very involved. Yes, Ron.
We are looking at, we have a very basic framework for an apprentice program, but we can only probably handle 3 or 4 kids. We need something more robust.
Yeah. All right. We are going to, first of all, say thank you to each of you. Thank you for what you do each and every day as well. Paul, Tom, thank you again. And we're going to adjourn this workshop, and we'll reconvene as school board meeting at 3:30.